Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hurry, hurry, hurry. It is, in fact, Moran Monday on the horn. A minute past 6 p.m. on the East Coast. I'm Bob, and we are ready for another wonderful week of God only knows what coming our way. But it is Moran Monday, and we have nominees. Oh, yes, we have nominees for Moran Monday. Without a doubt. And also, let's see, a couple of little announcements here and there. Let's see, coming up this Thursday, I will be in absentia. I'll be in absentia because of my local anti-mountaintop removal meeting. So I hope you will forgive me that. But it's, well, it just comes with the territory when you're trying to save your home. So that's, and also coming up, and I'll have the date for you later. We will be taking the show on the road. We will be taking it to West Virginia State University down in Institute for lectures by Ray McGovern and Bob Perry, Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com, what Bart Kopp once upon a time called the most important website on the Internet. And we will be broadcasting that live. And here's the hitch, or here's the wrinkle, if you will. We're going to try something different. We are in fact going to try to stream video of the event live to the world. Frankly, a big part of and I hope everybody had a happy Valentine's Day weekend. Yada yada. I don't pay a lot of attention to Valentine's Day. It gets me in big trouble around here. Happy Valentine's Day, Daddy. Well, happy Valentine's Day to you. It's just another messed up, well, not messed up, but, you know, just another excuse to sell greeting cards in my book. Wow, am I cynical? But anyway, yeah, you get the idea. In fact, Eugene Finnerman, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, did a take on Valentine's Day. And well, yeah, so what? It's Moran Monday. We can have a run at that. Just to give you an idea, Eugene wrote he sent it for Valentine's Day itself. Writing, if only Saint Valentine practiced what he preached. Roman emperors have feelings too. The Emperor Claudius II, 268 to 270, that's not how long he lived, that's how long he reigned. There weren't any two-year-old emperors. Well, not till later. Was feeling unappreciated, coping with barbarian invasions and rebellious governors. Poor fella didn't even have time to pick an original name for himself. Everyone was confusing him with the stammering, limping hero of PBS, as played by, come on, Bob, Derek Jacobi. There we go. Claudius. And when Claudius II did manage to defeat the Goths and the Alemanni, delaying for 150 years the Dark Ages and Richard Wagner, did anyone bother to thank him? No. The pagans were preoccupied with bread, circuses, and orgies, and that new monotheistic cult refused to make just a few sacrifices in his honor. Not even one. Even the old monotheist cult was more amenable than that. Of course, it took three lost wars, the destruction of Jerusalem, and expulsion from Judea to remind the Jews to include a few perfunctory prayers for the emperor. However, the new cult was dogmatic in its refusal, preferring persecution to courtesy. It really seemed unfair to Claudius and the empire. Christianity was an ingrate. Roman roads made it easy for missionaries, and the fresh water from the aqueducts ensured that baptisms didn't cause cholera.
Apart from the aqueducts, and apart from the roads, what's Rome ever done for us?
Now, you remember the scene from Life of Brian, right? But Eugene asks, would it have been too much for St. Valentine to send the emperor a thank you note? Well, it was, and hence, consequently, Valentine's Day, which was spent very quietly around here. But, okay, so I hope everybody had a happy Valentine's Day, which was the point of all of that anyway. Did you? Good. It is Moran Monday on the horn, and you know, this is the, and just a reminder, we made a joint decision, a collective decision last week to retire, Caribou Barbie's, palm reader? She can't compete anymore. She's out of the running. She's just too. She is so far above the rest of the field in Moranery. Ooh, I invented a new word. Or Moranity, or Moran-ness. It's sort of the Platonic ideal, I suppose. She can't compete anymore. So, that lets her out. But that's okay. Because we got lots of Morans out there. And hopefully your own nominee for right-wing Moran of the Week, just as quickly as you can get it to me via email or telephone, it works fine either way. Me, my number one nominee for Moran Monday has got to be Indiana Democrat in name only, Senator Evan Bayh. Evan Bayh announced that he's tired of being a senator. He is tired of being a member of the world's most exclusive club. That announcement coming earlier today. And, I first read about it about 10 minutes till noon. He's decided against running for a third term this year, which would mean he's at 12 years, and that would put him finishing a third term at 18 years in the Senate. 12 years, I suppose, is enough for him. He had a press conference at 2 p.m., and what I have in front of me is a copy of the remarks he was slated to deliver about 4 hours ago. 2 weeks ago, the Senate voted down a bipartisan commission to deal with one of the greatest threats facing our nation, our exploding deficits and debt. The measure would have passed, but 7 members who had endorsed the idea instead voted no for short-term political reasons. Just last week, a major piece of legislation to create jobs, the public's top priority, fell apart amid complaints from both the left and the right. All of this and much more has led me to believe that there are better ways to serve my fellow citizens, my beloved state, and our nation than continued service in Congress. He's running away. Oh, look at him. He's scampered off.
Brave Sir Evan ran away.
No!
But he is. But here's the fun part. It's not that blue dog Evan Bayh, who can be routinely counted upon to do the wrong darned thing in any given instance. Oh, I don't know if I like being in this majority. I might... No. Letting everybody go to the doctor in America when they're sick? That's too wibble-wool. Too progressive. Big baby. So I'm not all broken up about the fact that Evan Bayh is stepping down. You know, goodbye. Don't let the door hit you where the dear Lord split you. But it's how he's stepping down.
because it's all, and granted, I know there are some liberals in Indiana because we have listeners who are from there. Our good buddy Gerard comes to mind immediately. And there are other liberals in Indiana. But what Evan Bayh did was to make it almost dead certain that it will be something near to impossible for someone to get on the ballot in order to run against whoever the Repiglican is, which, under the circumstances, might very well wind up being that screamingly conservative, utterly insane nut job, Mike Pence. You know, he's one of those defenders of fetuses types with the perfect helmet hair. Yeah, that guy. Might wind up being him. And the seat may very well go to some wingnut, some bagger, birther, deather, tenther, booger eater by default. Why? Well, because it will, in order to qualify for the ballot in Indiana, a candidate has to have 500 valid signatures from citizens in Indiana's 9 congressional districts. I take that to be an aggregate as I read it. Out of 9 congressional districts, there have to be 500 valid signatures on an application for candidacy for proper certification. Guess when the deadline is to get all those 500 signatures and put together an entire campaign machine, because you see, Evan Bayh already had a campaign machine put together when he decided to pull out. That would be Friday. Friday, as in Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, this Friday. So it would seem that the Blue Dog has deliberately put a stick in the spokes of any hopes of maintaining that seat on the majority side of the aisle. Not that Evan Bayh was ever much of a member of the majority in the first place. Oh, and by the way, intrepid Senate leader Harry Reid, you want to know how he found out about all this? This is the leader, the majority leader of the Senate of the United States, who literally has his thumb on the pulse beat of his caucus in the Senate, but not really, no, not so much. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid learned that Evan Bayh was pulling out. When he read it in the media, in the for-profit media. That's right. Evan Bayh didn't even afford the Senate Majority Leader because, you know, Harry's kind of a doormat. And he doesn't do much in the way of leading in his position. Evan Bayh didn't even pick up the phone and call him on the front end and say, hey, Hare? Yeah, it's Ev. I'm not having any fun doing this anymore. I've got my perpetual health care. I've got a nice pension for the rest of my natural born days. You know, I think I'm going to knock off. Because that Mike Pence, he's a real mean guy. And I got a feeling, even though I'm a Dino, a Democrat in name only, I've got a feeling that if I have to run against Mike Pence in November, he's liable to make me wet myself. He might, you know what, Harry, and I know how you feel about this, because I know it's been done to you too, Harry. My sources are telling me that Mike Pence is, Harry, I can hardly stand to say it. Harry, my sources are telling me that Mike Pence is going to run a campaign and he's going to call me a liberal. Oh, God. I can't stand it, Harry. Calling me a liberal. You know I'm no liberal, Harry. No, the phone call didn't take place. And, of course, the President of the United States, who makes great speeches and gives excellent statements, said, "For more than two decades, Evan Bayh has devoted his career and his life to serving his fellow Hoosiers. During that time, he has fought tirelessly for Indiana's working families, reaching across the aisle on issues ranging from job creation and economic growth to fiscal responsibility and national security. I look forward to continuing to work with him on these critical challenges throughout the rest of the year. Michelle and I thank Senator Bayh for his leadership and service and wish him and his family all the best in their future endeavors." Yeah, he has. Evan Bayh has reached across the aisle a lot. He spent more time reaching across the aisle to a bunch of godforsaken, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, old Confederacy repiglickins than he has working with his own caucus. Goodbye, Evan. You moron.
Now listen to Bobby's calling name.
No, I'm being told, no, the party can still nominate someone after Friday. It's just that an individual is foreclosed from applying. What Bye-Bye, oh, that's cute, Benny, that's cute. What Bye-Bye did was ensure that no liberal would get to run for the seat, that the party would get to select a blue dog. Well, either way you slice it, it's a screwing, right? I'm being told by Ron and Raleigh that Dan Coats is planning to go back to the Senate, and he will more than likely win the upcoming election. That'd be fine. And maybe that's who the party is going out there and going to get nominated to run. But there's still a machine to be built. A campaign to be financed, and a Republican to be beaten. I remember when everybody was absolutely just, you know, well, come on, I mean, it's Walter Mondale. He can't possibly, you know, it's so sad that Senator Wellstone died or was killed. But, you know, Walter Mondale's a seasoned political veteran. He won't have any problem with some miserable, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, drooling, idiot right-winger. Come on, it's Mondale. That's how we got Senator Norm Coleman, if I recall correctly. David in Tennessee saying, "Methinks that the Bye guy left in a hurry because he needed to. I smell bad choice of words. I sense a dead girl or a live boy about to present themselves, maybe both." Yeah, hey, it's politics. It's always possible. Oh, and by the way, nominees for Moran Monday, I don't know about the rest of you, but I nominate me. I nominate me going back to last Friday night and the shooting in Huntsville, Alabama. Because, you know, it wasn't like I was acting in bad faith. I was acting completely in good faith. We had a shooting in a red state at a biology department, and there were a lot of, and all of the little dominoes were just lining up, and it looked like, you know, just another red state crime of passion. Whew, man, did I miss it. I sat there after the show was over Friday night and into Saturday morning and into Sunday just watching the updates come in on this story. Cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. What was her name? Bishop? Dr. Bishop was a loony. And a homicidal one at that.
You know, I think if you can take it at face value, that wonderful, wonderful novel Aztec by Gary Jennings that was published in like 1980 and which was based on 10 years of him living among the people and learning the Nahuatl language. He maintains that the Mexica people had two different words for crazy, and one of them was tlahuele, and I forget what the other one was, but one meant just harmlessly nuts, and the other one meant dangerously, homicidally insane. Well, it would appear that Dr. Bishop was of the dangerously, homicidally insane variety. In the last couple of days, I've seen her tied to what had been a closed case file of the shotgun death of her own brother when he was 18 in Braintree, Mass. And I've also seen an account of her being a suspect in a bomb plot at Harvard. And then there was the reference that was made as she was getting into the patrol car or whatever, where she said, no, that's impossible. They're all alive in there. Woohoo! And this was the best part. It was an unregistered firearm. This is what came from the authorities in Alabama. It was an unregistered firearm, and we have no idea where she would have got one of those. No, neither do I, Sparky. Not in Alabama. No. Where? The mind reels. I'm boggled. So far from some right-wing nefarious plot, of which they are frequently capable, and we have had, you got the murder, the assassination of Dr. Tiller, you got the shooting at Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, you got a lot out there to suggest a possibility. But I very, very clearly, I didn't jump the gun, I leaped it. I've been thinking about it all weekend. It's the radio equivalent of sitting in sackcloth and ashes. I should know better than to do something like that with breaking news, but I did it anyway, and hence I nominate Bob Kincaid, for Moran Monday. Now I don't know if I can compete with Evan Bayh. I'm not sure at all. But I most assuredly do nominate me for Moran Monday. And, you know, maybe just in general principle, maybe I need to be nominated periodically just to sort of keep me honest. Yeah, Sparky, you could get, gun show at the county fairgrounds. Yeah, you could get an unregistered firearm there, or 20, in Alabama. Tennessee, or Mississippi, or Georgia. Sure. Why not? But I blew it. But at least I've got the guts and gumption, right? To admit the same. So we got that. A great big and this is one of those. This is another nominee, and it's sort of a collective nominee, if you will. To the Detroit school system. Apparently, some schools in Detroit have decided to offer a class, and this is kind of hard to work through because I can't really make it, it's ever so wrong inside my brain. Sandra sent this story along to me over the weekend and was just as gobsmacked as was I with the comment, I'm sure Booker T. Washington would approve. Walmart has been widely condemned for offering its employees only low-paying, dead-end jobs. Even President Obama, this is from Raw Story. Even President Obama criticized Hillary Clinton during the 2008 presidential campaign for having served on Walmart's board and stated that the firm ought to pay a living wage. Okay. In inner city Detroit, however, where the unemployment rate is estimated at an astonishing 50%, the prospect of a Walmart job may appear far more attractive. And here's the hook. Four inner city Detroit high schools have decided that employment with Walmart is an opportunity worth training their students to pursue. The schools have teamed up with Walmart itself to offer a four-credit class in job readiness training that also includes entry-level after-school jobs. One of the principals at one of the four schools said optimistically, and I quote, "The program will allow students an opportunity to earn money to be exposed to people from different cultures since all of the stores are in the suburbs." Oh, that's Excedrin headache number 612. What's, I'm just asking, what's the curriculum like for how to Walmart? And are there, you know, are there subsections for greeter? No, those are all octogenarians. Stock clerk, cashier. "Hello, child. This is a cash register. It's got a scanner. Move the product across the scanner and place it in the bag." Really? A four-credit class? Is this along the same lines as back when the Bush administration Labor Department tried to reclassify working at McDonald's as industrial labor? Or manufacturing, that's what it was, manufacturing. Now, it's bad enough that here in West Virginia, in our community colleges, we have classes that teach young people how to be coal miner. How to coal miner. We have, no, literally, you can go to community college in southern West Virginia and take Coal Miner 101. And if you want to follow the mountaintop removal track, they've got D9 Caterpillar 102, Explosives 103, So I can only get, what do you got? I'm guessing this is not a good idea, because I think a general education diploma from a high school is enough to get you a job at Walmart, assuming there's a job to be had. But then again, it's a vast cultural cross-section experience, as Walmart associates will meet people from the suburbs. Is this the part where Ava Gabor sings, "Goodbye, City Lights"? Bless her heart, Donna Stern, the Midwest coordinator for the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, and Immigrant Rights, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. I can't even begin to comprehend what that acronym would be. Says they're going to train students to be subservient workers. This is not why parents send them to school. But more and more, it is why school systems exist. Let's see. Walmart in the past has sponsored a letter writing contest in which students could win classroom supplies. Well, okay, I don't have a problem with that. And at Christmas, Walmart donated presents to needy students in a Detroit suburb. Now, bear in mind, these four schools are predominantly black schools, okay? And rather than giving these children dreams of perhaps going to college or pursuing some higher level of education or going out and getting a skill or a trade, they are going to be shuffled out into the Detroit suburbs to say welcome to Walmart to the white folks. Inspiring, isn't it? No, I didn't think so. Me neither. So at least I think we've got a start on what I hope would be a start on what I hope will be a vigorous Moran Monday. Do feel free to jump in with your nominees, your thoughts, whatever. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, if you want to save us the toll-free money, you can reach us at 304-658-3333. We'll take a little break. Going back to, there we go. Going back to Huntsville. This is the horn.
Did it really happen? Was I really there? Was I really there with you? We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of wine and stars. Fell on Alabama that night. I can't forget the glamour. Your eyes held a tender light, and stars fell on Alabama last night. I never planned in my imagination a situation so heavenly. A fairy land that no one else could enter, and in the center just you and me. Dear, my heart beat like a hammer. My arms went around you tight, and stars fell on Alabama last night. All right, let's take it on down to Muscle Shoals through Decatur. Birmingham. Right up over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown, Mr. T. A situation so heavenly. A fairy land that no one else could enter, and in the center just you and me. Dear, my heart beats like a hammer. My arms went round you tight. On Alabama last night. as we live. Our little drama we kissed on the dance so wide, and stars fell on Alabama last night.
Yeah, there's never a bad time to run a little Jimmy Buffett somewhere along the way. That's just nice. It is it's about 25 minutes before the hour. And remind me, see, you get to sort of looking out there in the wide, wide world for morans, and you forget the morans right under your nose. I got a moran right under my nose, and, whew, man, live one, to the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, listen, yeah, that Walmart business, that's pretty damn, frightening.
Yeah, it is, and it's fraught with stupidity too, because as David in Tennessee is pointing out, that Detroit has the acknowledged worst public transport in the country. How are they going to get the kids from the inner city to the burbs?
Yeah, I would think that Walmart's going to donate some buses.
And every snide, snarky comment that I would make following from that, I'm just not going to do it, Sandra.
Well, you know what I'm saying? Not only that, but the whole article is like, oh, wait a minute. These four little black children, they're going to see what, whitey in the suburbs? What cultural differences? What the hell are they talking about?
Oh, I know. That was the...
That was just so disturbing. I'm like, the principal said what?
Well, but that's the desperate attempt of someone who has just been caught doing a stupid thing to try to find something good to say about it.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, it's just so loaded, you know what I mean? And the fact that we've come full circle back to 1957, I mean, where am I?
I know.
In fact, not 1957, what am I saying? 1857, you know?
Well, there's that, yes.
I mean... I couldn't really believe that they're basing policy in this way. It's sort of, they completely pulled the sheet off.
But in so many ways, Sandra, and I think you probably, and I don't want to make you say anything you didn't want to say, but you probably see the after effects of some of this stuff doing what you do on a daily basis. Our public education system is a crippled mess right now that has not been made better, but has been made manifestly worse by No Child's Behind left.
Well, not only that, but I mean, with the kids that are getting into state schools, there's such a high level of hand holding. I can't even begin to tell you. I'm like, how are these people going to function as adults? I mean, they've had parents tell them how wonderful they are every day of their lives since they was old enough to understand. They get to college, I don't know what they're expecting. You see what I mean?
Well, yeah, I do. And to be honest, I don't... I know there are people like that. I just can't imagine... Because, I mean, now, while with our kids here, you know, it's not a constant barrage of, hey, you suck, do better. we're honest with them.
No, I mean,
when they were six and brought home the crayon drawings for the refrigerator, yeah, it was, oh, honey, that's just beautiful. And I don't think you've quite got chiaroscuro down yet. No. But by the same token, now we're at a place where, for instance, Ferg is writing for his middle school newspaper, and we're doing some serious work on grammar.
Well, no. My whole room is full of paintings from the twins. You know, some are good, some aren't. And, you know, of course, they're much more sheltered because, you know, everyone's so freaked out. If you pop outside, something bad might happen. But that actually is self-perpetuating, too, you know. You sort of have to kind of let go a bit because these poor kids can't even walk home from school. You know what I'm saying?
Now, that I'm guilty of.
Well, no.
I mean, I sit here because I've got a 16. I got a 22-year-old daughter. I got a 16-year-old daughter. I got a 14-year-old son and an almost 13-year-old daughter. And the proposition of any of the three younger ones ever being behind the wheel of an automobile just fills me with overarching dread.
Well, the thing is, you know, we can't really because it's just not the same. You know what I mean? But the trade-off is that the kids aren't very self-sufficient or self-reliant, you know?
Not at all. And haven't been... And, you know, Dr. Bill O'Brien is a great resource on this, too. He knows, he sees on a daily basis what the world is like for these kids trying to, you know, trying to pursue some sort of an education. And, you know, it's pathetic, to be quite honest, not to put words in his mouth, but it's pathetic. And you know, I can see it in my own kids' education, Sandra. You cannot teach a child to spell with multiple choice tests.
And no, I mean, yeah, no, the standards are bad, but also, and I hate to say this, I'm kind of done with the never-ending reinforcement of self-esteem to the point of no return, which is part of the problem why these folks can't function now in this recession, you know? You can't take orders, you know, you have to be creative now when shit is hard, you see? And if you're constantly being pumped up all the damn time, you know, you're not going to have any life skills to function out there. That's just my opinion, but I think a lot of these young people are in for a world of hurt.
Well, I fear that you're correct, and yet it sort of remains to be seen, because somehow or another the young human of the species does find a way most of the time to wind up an old human. But the question, I think, is one of quality over quantity, Sandra, because. What do we want these generations to be? Do we want them to be fully functioning, self-actuated members of society? You know, good law-abiding taxpayers, as the phrase used to go, or do we want them to be obedient proles?
Well, see, that's the thing, and I mean, getting back to what you asked me about, you know, I hate to go on, but you touched the nerve. Like, for example, this one kid came up to me the other day. I had to grade a quiz out of 10. I gave him a 6. Okay, it was a 6. This fool got real close to me, upset about his grade. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, hey, you don't know who the hell you're talking to. I didn't say that. You know, you have protocol. But I'm thinking, are you kidding me with this? Kid, back up. This is why it's wrong. But they come at you as if they're entitled. And it's like, no, go to your mama for that. Right now, here, this is college.
Exactly.
They don't seem to make the connection. I guess I don't know if they're waiting for someone to clean up or take care or what, but you can't just write gibberish and expect to get A's anymore. You know what I mean?
Nor should you ever have been.
Right, but that's not the case, and a lot of, you know, in the state college system, you know, you have such a variety of classes with different expectations, and unfortunately, a lot of them just sort of slide these people through. And they take government, and they're like, oh my God, I don't know what's going on, so they freak out, because it's not a very easy subject when you watch cartoons and play video games your whole adolescence, you know what I mean?
Very much so. And there was a stunning statistic several years back that talked about the number of books that a college graduate, now we're talking a college graduate here, Sandra, the number of books that a college graduate on average will read after college is done. And it was shockingly low, like, you know, one or two. And I remember the hissy I had on air that night, because some percentage of those who read one or two books after they graduate, you know, one of them will be one or two or both, you know, three, all of them will be the Left Behind series.
Yeah, I know. I mean... Yeah, I vaguely remember that. It was just like they read what they had to in college, and once they got out, they had no idea what to do with a book. I mean, you know, but this is sort of away from the... Well, thing about the Walmart that's disturbing is how there's no more pretense about it. This is your life now. This is the best you can hope to get if you're some black inner-city kid, and be glad for it. You know, and it's just like...
Well, one of the Weisenheimers in the chat room, Sandra, pointed out that what we're quickly transitioning is away from the GED and to the WED, the Walmart Education, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just like some sort of bad, I don't know, bad theater when, you know, I remember reading stories and having my mother talk to me about how you were told that you were worthless, you can't amount to anything. You know, in the good old Jim Crow days. And yet and still, here we are. you know, reliving that for these poor young people in these horrific inner city schools, you know?
And I will have to say, there's something that kind of goes with this. I put it up on my Twitter feed. I hate that. But I put it up on my Twitter feed, and I'll shoot it to you. And I got to find some way to get stuff out there so folks can appreciate these things at the same all at the same time. I'm putting it in the chat room here too. It is a graphic representation, Sandra, of unemployment in the United States, and it's animated, and it happens over time, starting like 3 years ago to January of this year. And it's like watching a disease spread. And in fact, it is a disease spreading. And to have Evan Bayh on his way out complaining, whining, about the lack of bipartisanship or the lack of getting anything done in the Senate just makes me want to vomit.
Oh no, he's disgusting. I'm like, unbelievable when I heard that. I thought, you overprivileged prick. You know what I mean? I was just saying, he's appalling anyway. I don't, but that's a Republican now, state. That's what's going to be elected for Senate, though, right?
Well, Ron in Raleigh says that he thinks it'll be Dan Coats.
He sounds familiar. What was his deal?
He does sound familiar, and I can't pull anything specific out.
Now, maybe Ed Schultz is over there wrong.
No, still in the wrong state.
Oh, God. Well, listen, the thing about the Evan Bayh thing is that, you know, these Democrats, they have no clue about how to manage power.
So I understand now. I was misunderstanding a little bit. Dan Coats is a repig licking.
Okay.
That's not who's going to run on the Democratic side. I was jumping the gun.
Okay. They have to scramble and find somebody, right?
Yeah, the Democrats do have to scramble and find somebody if they can.
Yeah, I mean, that fool just pulls it out the hat, huh?
Yeah.
I'm leaving?
Yeah. It's busted camp.
I can't even believe how any party that has all three branches can implode like this. This is just stunning.
And you know, the thing is, if Evan Bayh would have ever once stood up and pointed out, as David is pointing out here, If Evan Bayh would have ever just stood up and bloodied and got his knuckles bloody on the nose of some recalcitrant right winger, he would have A, found out how liberating it is, how empowering it is, and it might have made his Senate experience a heck of a lot more gratifying. But instead, he chose this go along, get along, milk toast, sop, doormat, get in the way of progress approach, and no wonder it was no fun.
Oh, no, no. I mean, he was one of the people who was, a DLC, I wouldn't say leader, but follower for sure, right?
Well, look at the first thing he cries about, Sandra. He cries about the fact that the Senate rejected that deficit panel.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know. He's one of them, the ones that want to get a hold of Social Security. Yeah, no, he's a horror show.
Oh, and by the way, just for the sake of perspective, go back to yesterday, early or late Saturday, I'm not sure which, at crooksandliars.com. There's a guy there, I think his name's Gordon Skeen or something like that, who posts archival audio from time to time.
Uh-huh.
And I met him in Pittsburgh at Netroots Nation. He's got a ton of this stuff. And he really pulled out a gem this time, because it's an NBC radio broadcast of a speech delivered on May the 2nd, 1935, by Huey P. Long. And it is magnificent, Sandra. Because the way it was presented at Crooks and Liars is that Huey Long became an ardent foe of FDR and opposed everything that FDR stood for. Well, that's not how it shakes out. If you listen to this thing, it's like listening to Paul Krugman talk about Obama's economic policies and how they're not doing enough.
Oh no, Long. That was part of the reason why FDR moved the way he did, because what Long was offering was really scaring them rich assholes.
Well, you should hear what Long lays out in this lecture. He's talking about total taxation on estates at death over $5 million, and redistribution of wealth. And making sure that everybody actually lives in their own home.
Yeah, no,
and
no,
it,
no.
And you know what? Listening to it, and I've got a pretty jaundiced ear, Sandra, listening to it, it did not sound like demagoguery to me.
Well, I know. I mean, you know, they had to eliminate that rhetoric, because he was appealing to lots of folks. I think he was one of the more powerful characters in America for a minute there.
Right. He was a member of the United States Senate at the time, and at the beginning of the speech, the lecture, remarks, whatever, he says, "I have just returned from Des Moines, Iowa." God love him for saying Des Moines. Where he said, "I spoke to 20,000 people," and you know what? In that era, it was not unusual to do that sort of thing, but he'd spoken at some sort of a rally and laid out his agenda. And everybody, he said, you know, "When I asked for a show of hands, there wasn't a hand left down in the crowd, you know, for wanting this kind of equity."
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, that's what was at stake in the 30s. I mean, it's so fascinating to sort of look back at what actually was unfolding. And when you hear them demonizing Roosevelt, you're like, dude, he saved your ass, you know, because people really was ready to throw down.
Oh, yeah, and Long just rides him like a borrowed mule for being out swanning around on some rich dude's yacht.
Right. No. It was just like that back then. And, you know, of course, it was horrible times, you know, for people of color and stuff. But what I would give to be a fly in some of that time period, because it just sounds like people were just...
Well, if you consider the two sources... One, that speech is May of 1935. By September, Huey P. Long is dead.
Yeah, well, no, that was my next comment. I'm like, yeah, and then what? You know what I mean?
But couple that with what we found out in the last couple of years about Smedley Butler being, not found out, but sort of rediscovered, about Smedley Butler being approached by a syndicate, if you will, composed of the big money in this country that was made up of Rockefellers and Fords, and the Bush family, and several others, who actually wanted Smedley Butler to lead a coup against FDR and throw him out of office.
Yeah, no, that story is crazy, too. I mean, it's just the same group, but it feels like, Bob, that group has gotten in charge, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and he cites statistics. That's why I'm saying this is such a go-listen-to-it thing. He cites statistics. In 1935, he is appalled to state that 5% of the population controls 60% of the wealth of this nation.
Well, he must be spinning. Okay?
Yeah. And I'm noting here, I'm looking at something that Lottie's posted in the chat room, and Long's last words were reportedly, "God, don't let me die. I have so much left to do."
Yeah. Oh, no, I know, it is, it's just scary. I mean, if you look at just, as far as I can tell, I mean, I don't want to say it, but it just seems like that group has won, because how in the world is it that the Democratic Party, as it's constituted now, is in total disarray? I am just, I can't even believe it.
I think that time that they spend in the wilderness basically sucked all the life out of them. And people who were flawed human beings but who might have had some fight left in them, I think about Bob Graham from Florida. I think about Fritz Hollings from South Carolina. You know, none of them would have been ideologically perfect by any metric that you or I might, as liberals or progressives, apply, Sandra. but they would have been miles ahead of these milksops that we have now. And the idea of leadership, of being bold and being dynamic and taking the bull by the horns and the reins in your teeth and getting out there and taking the fight to the other side, I can't overstate it, Sandra, that is a lost concept within the Democratic Party.
No, it's just incredible. Now, now that you mentioned Trent Collins, I'm like, oh, my God, there's too much consuming going on here. I love him. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and you know, remember? Do you remember why he quit the Senate?
No, I don't.
He quit the Senate because he said, I am tired of spending all of my time going around hustling and huckstering up campaign cash when I've got hard work to do in the Senate and leading needs to be done.
Oh, God. No, that's, you know what? I think you really have hit a good point here. It's just, so we're dealing with a party that isn't able to lead. That's what you're telling me.
Yes, it can't. It could, if the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor tomorrow, the Democratic Congress could not find the will to lead.
No, and it's also, I am so sick to death of Obama going from the, you know, this bipartisan stuff. It's like a poison. It's unbelievable. I don't understand. You have power. I mean, Tom DeLay, you know, was he into bipartisanship?
No. Bill Frist, you know, I remember for a year you couldn't turn on the television without Bill Frist standing there in front of a camera, sounding like he had a mouthful of grit, saying, all we want is an up or down vote. Where's our side now that literally hundreds of Obama nominees have languished waiting for a confirmation vote? Where's our side? Just one senator that will stand up and use those bastards' own medicine against them. All we want's an up or down vote. That's all we want's an up or down vote.
And explain to me how this fool is able to hold these people for so long, yet Sanders put a hold on Bernanke, and all of a sudden...
And got slapped down a rat hole yesterday.
Right. You understand what I mean? So don't tell me that it's inability to lead. I just, you know, it makes me just think that...
No, I think it is inability. It is certainly unwillingness. But it is inability. Okay, maybe it's not inability. Maybe it is want of political courage.
Well, no, because
cowardice.
How was he able to drum up get the hold off of Bernanke, but all these other people? You see what I'm saying?
Well, because Harry Reid had power,
right,
over Bernie Sanders. But he is absolutely powerless. I mean, Republicans are like kryptonite to Harry Reid.
Yeah, it's just bizarre. He has a good chance of being defeated too, right? I mean, as an ex.
Yeah, his only hope is that his Republican opponents, all of whom are vying against each other in a primary, will so rankle with each other. He's waiting for a New York 23 to happen, basically. He's waiting for the Republicans to splinter just enough for him to get a plurality, if not a majority.
Okay, and so the next thing now is this meeting with the Republicans again, with Obama, another one, about health care?
Yeah, the trap. I don't know if you saw the Jon Stewart piece. It was called The Apparent Trap. It was one of the most hilarious pieces of political video that he may ever have done. It was just gorgeous. The Republican, and I mentioned it on Friday and used it as a cheap excuse to play Elvis's Suspicious Minds. But it's being played as this devious trap that President Obama is setting for the Republicans. But as Jon Stewart noted, it's only a trap if you ain't got nothing to bring. If you got nothing and you're coming to the meeting, it is a trap. Because everybody's going to figure out you got nothing.
Well, yeah, but didn't Obama come out for a brief second and threaten? And then they threatened some recess appointments, and then some movement happened? And then he retreated again, right?
Yeah. Because Richard Shelby backed off of 67, I think.
Yeah, but there's like 110 that are being held up, I heard.
Yeah, but he was holding, he was personally holding 70.
Okay, and please explain to me, why is the head of the DEA still there, the Bush guy?
Beats me.
Oh, he was reappointed, actually. I'm just fine.
Well, why is the acting U.S. attorney for the Western District of Louisiana still the right-wing daddy of that right-wing punk that was involved in the bugging of Mary Landrieu's office?
Right, that's what I'm saying. So it's just sort of... Okay, so let's just go down to a couple of years away from now. Are we to believe that he's going to be president, or is it going to be right back to what it was like in the year 2000, Bob? I'm serious.
You know, I hear people like Howard Dean say things like the Democratic, and you know, he said this. He said it to Rachel Maddow the other night. The Democratic Party needs a spine implant. And I hear things like this, and I'm wondering, Howard, are you thinking what I'm thinking, Howard? But I really would hate for Howard to run in the primary against Barack Obama and get Bill Bradley'd. So.
Well, no, but see, this is where I'm stuck. You know, I'm in my little world here doing, you know, trying to live my life as best as I can, thinking if all this power fell in my lap, I'd be goddamn if I didn't know what to do with it. You understand what I'm saying, Bob?
Yep. Yeah, I do.
No problem here. None.
No. March out and start doing stuff and Katie bar the door.
Not a minute it would take for me to figure out what the hell.
But what's going on is there's this political calculus in Washington, Sandra, that says we don't actually have to win. We just have to wait for the other side to screw up.
No, but
and toward that end, you've got Michael the Savage Wiener. This guy hasn't been featured on anything anywhere forever, but he came out and just ripped into Sarah Palin. If you want Obama for a second time, just make sure that Sarah Palin is the Republican nominee. And I'm telling you that if they make that idiotic mistake of pushing her as their lead candidate, it's over. Obama will get a second time, no matter how bad his presidency has been. So... And he goes on, you know, she's not electable as president. She doesn't have the gravitas. He doesn't either. She's not the right person. We need a businessman. We need someone with guts, preferably someone who served in the military. I may have to run that audio later because he's such a delight to hear him have an aneurysm.
Oh, God. I mean, I keep thinking that guy's going to stroke out in public, on the air.
We can hope.
Well, no, but this, you know, because this is, I'm tripping on people not, you know, not being able to use the power. I mean, Obama got elected. He has 4 years. You understand? I don't care if they have to start, but they're acting like they're going to be turned out tomorrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just.
And what happens, Sandra, is they become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
No, but only the Democrats do that. When Republicans are in power, you know, you and I are running for the hills.
Yeah, and propriety or anything else be damned, they are going to get their agenda through.
Exactly, you know, because I was just in awe of some of the shit that went down during the Bush years.
It was breathtaking. It was truly breathtaking to see, you know, the Medicare prescription plan, Part D, the way that that thing got passed with the arm twisting and the rule breaking and the frankly, the heavy, the ham-fisted thuggery that went on.
Remember Conyers was banished to the basement?
Yeah.
I don't mean to laugh.
You know, remember, we lived for 8 years in a world where the vice president of the United States could look at the ranking minority member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and tell him to F off.
No, and all we get from Reid is, oh, you need to do recess appointments. I can't handle this. You know what I'm saying? It's just funny.
Yeah, but that's because Harry Reid is able to exert power over reasonable Democrats that are willing to cooperate with him. You know, if you're a mavericky blue dog, like Evan Bayh, you can not call Harry when you're quitting, and if Harry wants something from you, you can tell him to go piss up a rope. And Harry Reid will piss himself and run away crying.
I keep wondering what he's talking about, 84 boxer. That's like, it's just a joke, isn't it?
Oh, it's...
Well, anyway,
wore it all out. I get, you know, didn't leave nothing in the ring and didn't have nothing to take out of it either.
Oh God! Well, anyway, listen, I'm sure you have other people, so I'll move along.
All right, take care, Sandra. Great conversation. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now. Calling from California. That's Sandra. And let's see, let's keep things rolling here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, you got me?
I got you. Is this Fancy?
Uh-huh.
I'd know that voice anywhere.
Hi, sweetie. I'm saying let's not be too quick to, with the retail sales training. And we started on this, and I'm trying to put together a few things. Now, when I was growing up, there was like a work study where one could work and get,
Oh, we had something similar in my high school too.
But there is no retail anymore, and this is close to my heart because I grew up. My dad had a shoe store,
mm-hmm.
and the people that worked in my dad's shoe store, one I know went on into major retail, and that you know everybody's not going to, but some are, and so
market exists.
Okay, yeah, which is now pretty much, we'll get back to this. So I want to give a few thoughts that came up here. And, you know, I lived in Rome for a while. And
New York or Georgia?
The other one.
Oh.
And I remember talking to an American in the priesthood. We were having coffee one day. I don't remember what we were doing together, but he was telling us, when students come from third world countries, and they come to study in Rome. And he says, and he makes a point that one can be very uneducated and not be and still be very intelligent. But he says one of the first things they did when they brought in students from third world countries is they said, this is a clock, and this is how you tell time, and this is how you set an alarm on a clock, and because. You know, you and I, and almost everyone we knew grew up in a home where there was a clock. And not only was there a clock, it kept good time. You know, you had regular electricity, and it didn't go out. And pretty much if you knew you had to be at work at 8, you knew you set your clock for whatever it was you did. And then, and I was thinking, one of the things he used as an example was checks. These are people who had never had any experience with checks. And it suddenly hit me that neither have my grandkids. You know, that in our family.
Or balancing a checkbook or balancing an account. Or yeah.
You know, my grandkids will say, Grandma would take this piece of paper out and she'd write her name on it and you could take it to the bank and you'd get money. But, you know, you and I grew up in a period where checks were pretty common.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're talking about, and what I'm getting here is just cultural knowledge. That what is, you know, I'm going to guess you actually, I know you grew up in a house and there were books.
No.
There are people who grew up in homes, and the only book was a bodice tearing novel and a bodice ripper novel, and the TV guide, and that was the entire reading matter in the family. One of the jokes that we used to have was after my kids had got shots or went to the doctor, I would never take them for ice cream because too many adults, you know, I've been to the doctor and now I have to go for ice cream. And I said, what I did is after my kids went to the doctor, we went to the library. And I had visions, my kids would grow up and they'd say, I've had a doctor's appointment, now I got to go check out a book. But it's even worse than that, my daughter's a librarian. So, you know, you have this cultural awareness. And I was talking with a friend earlier, and his wife is the manager of a gift shop that's attached to the mission. And you talk about wonderful retail. The Gray Line bus pulls up 8 times a day.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is. It's a beautiful mission here we have. We have several beautiful missions. And she took the gift shop from a unfortunate reality, which was pretty much shoplifter's delight, into something that actually made money and has taste and whatever. And she's now at retirement age, and they don't want her to retire because there's no one to replace her. There's no one. She grew up, her father was wholesale, but she grew up with the knowledge of retail business. And she could walk up to anybody. She would, you know, she was showing me a little stand that stood on a counter that had earrings. And she said, you know, this 9 inches grosses X number of dollars a year. And she knew what it did. And she knew where to put it. And she knew how to gross X number of dollars a year, which was very impressive. And so just learning basics of retail, it's not that simple to, you know, to run the reader over the barcode. But in aggregate, the whole process of being there on time, of figuring this, of figuring that, of doing display, of doing whatever, and there's going to be one or two people who come out of that with a sense of retail that they can use in the rest of their lives. They may not end up selling earrings at Walmart, but they may end up selling cars at a major dealership or opening their own. And it's not going to happen to everybody, but it will happen to somebody. And this is kind of...
Well, that's true. That's all very true. The only problem being that the Walmart model is not the model for going out and setting up your own stop.
No, what
or shop.
Do,
the other thing.
The Walmart model will teach you on time to work. Your hair is combed. You're polite. You know,
there's a sort of seedy downside to this is why are these programs being introduced in inner city Detroit high schools instead of inside high schools in those same Detroit suburbs where the stores are?
Well, yeah, and I'm going to get back to that on a different on another level. But I do want to finish this up by saying that what happens with somebody is they're going to say, this is interesting. I think I need more math when I get to junior college. I think I need this or that. And they may actually get a degree in this area of business. Or they may find a business where they can proceed, and that's good. Now, another thing I want to talk about, and that is the integration aspect, not of color, but again of culture. And I'm going to use Dallas as an image here, because what happened in Dallas was when integration came, the kids in Plano had no problem with integration. They just, you know, black kids and white kids went to school because dad was an engineer at IBM. Or dad was this or that. The black kids and the white kids were culturally on a pretty equal basis. The level was fine. And then they started busing children into North Dallas, little upscale, tight-ass North Dallas. And here's a kid who just said exactly what his mother had said at breakfast, and he's in the principal's office. You know, because you can't say fucking school on the north side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they was raised right.
Well, and you know, I sing along on prayer meeting time because I know about this culture. But it's a little point that it's not the black or the white.
Well, in what you're describing then, is it culture or is it class, Fancy?
It's very much class, but it is the culture of the class. And you know, to let me find a good word here. Well, within a culture in which there is very little reading, you know, the height of reading is the TV guide. Education is. The pastor said it, so I know it, and I'm hence educated. there's the need to defend and fight. What you believe is wrong and what I believe is right. And we've heard this from people who, you know, who couldn't run their timetables. But what they know is right. When you get into retail, you can't walk up to a customer and say, don't read that damn book, it's full of lies. You say, you're interested in buying that book? That's a good book. You know, you may not agree with everything in it, but I'm selling books here. I'm not arguing with principles.
Yeah, right. You can have the Bodice Ripper, or you can have the Left Behind series, or, well, then again, Walmart doesn't carry The Origin of the Species. But
oh, I'm gonna wander down the path here. I needed some blocks to raise up a chair that tipped back farther than I liked. And so I went to the hardware store, and I said, you know, I need some blocks. And they said, guys, I don't have this. He says, what you're going to want to do is, he says, you know, go to one of the bigger stores where they cut wood and get those blocks cut. So as I was thinking about it, I thought, well, I don't need wood blocks. And I went down to the neighborhood secondhand shop, the thrift shop, where paperbacks are sold for a quarter each. And I got four paperbacks, two and two, the same size. So when you stacked them, you had two, you know, and they made precisely the height of and size of the block I wanted. And so I taped them together with brown tape, and then I painted the brown tape with a dollar's worth of spray-on paint, and I had a very nice block to raise up a chair, which pleased me tremendously with my own ingenuity. But my second thought was, I took four of the Left Behind series off the shelf, which I considered a public
service. Oh, atta girl. That is a public service.
That was a public service on my part.
And frankly, they're doing as much good as... those books taken together are probably doing more good right now than any other single volume of the Left Behind series has ever done.
I would think so. So much for creative use of unfortunate literature.
Oh, by the way, you've been awarded a toaster for the evening.
Oh, I get the toaster.
Yes, you get the toaster for the left for your use of the Left Behind series.
That's a wonderful one, and I will treasure it.
Oh, I do. You know, they come wide enough for bagels.
This is totally off the subject, but I've got friends I hang out with online, and I got, you know, I've got one guy I dated for years. I never met him, and we're not talking cyber sex here, although I'm not opposed to that anyway. But we would go to museums together, and we'd look at the pictures, and you know, we'd say, where do you want to go tonight? And he'd say, oh, I don't know, let's go to the Louvre, and well, let's go to this, and we'd end up in front of the same painting or sculpture or ceramic. And we might talk about it, and we might talk about something else. So anyway, I've got a friend doing that. And for Valentine's Day, he sent me a picture of roses, which is very nice. But he also sent me, and it was adorable. It was like, you know, candy you get in paper, and it's curled at both ends.
Yes.
Twisted at both ends.
Right.
Except this was Venetian glass.
Oh, my God.
Is that exquisite?
Oh, that is.
And I'm sugar, and very sugar free. And, you know, he sent me a picture of them, and I said, and of course I answered him for the roses with the Madeline Kahn line from Blazing Saddles. A red, red rose. How romantic.
How romantic.
A red rose.
Oh,
more got me off on Madeline Kahn.
Yeah, I know.
An incredible.
No schnitzen, Gruben, Schatzi?
I'm tired. So tired.
Oh, baby, I am not from Havana.
I ran the...
That whole scene is just magic.
Well, that's... The entire movie is it's a monument to bad taste. And two, I love it.
Oh, it's a monument to bad taste masterfully done.
The farting scene is just awesome.
Well, you know, Mel Brooks is an Indian. Yeah, oof, let him go. Those people are darker than we are. Oi!
Oi! I'm wandering way far afield in topic tonight. But I think that we are going to have to find ways to help people find their way. And
I guess what's disturbing, I mean, this thing's, the thing out of professional speaker, my rear end.
Didn't it done that?
What is disturbing to me?
Your Michael Savage is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I've worked on him for years. Yeah. The thing that is most so many layers, it's such a noxious little onion, but one of the more disturbing things out of the Detroit story is the assumption that kids in inner city Detroit are not worthy of having an economic model built up around them, that instead we will take them to where the model already exists. You know, there are parts of Detroit now, if I understand correctly, that are literally returning to the wild. Just as the lianas and jungle, the foliage engulfed the pyramids in Central America.
And this has happened in other cities. What was that? In Brooklyn, there was Fort Apache, and there's a whole area that was a no man's land. This happens in cities too. When I was in high school, it suddenly hit me one day, or maybe took time occurring, but is, oh my God, they're training us to be good little bookkeepers and accountants. We all know how to keep our margins straight, and we all know how to do this and that, and what we don't know is how to think for ourselves. And of course, and I public education for me was kind of an affront even then, is that we were being trained to be good employees. And I'm not so uptight. And I'm the one who always says that the artistic child is the child who has to defend from the very beginning. That when they say, what do you want to be when you grow up, honey? And you say, I want to be a fireman. I want to be a nurse. Well, fat chance. But they say, isn't that nice? And then they say, and what do you want to be when you grow up? And you say, I want to write stories. I want to tap dance. I want to sing songs. I want to act in plays. And they say, yes, but what do you really want to do?
You know, I was so lucky. I had this conversation off air the other night. I knew a lot of kids whose parents were actively involved in, you know, thou shalt be a fill in the blank.
The
but
first
it was,
kid's the doctor, the second kid's the attorney. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. My parents were never like that. Fancy. They said, you know, my dad was a furnace operator. My mother was a frustrated writer, genius postmistress and all kinds of that sort of stuff, munitions maker.
Yes.
And she, neither one of them ever said, well, you know, wouldn't you like to be a, and it was just, well, you know, go study what you're going to study. Learn something.
How is this kid going to support herself?
Probably more attention should have been paid to that, because a little guidance would have been nice somewhere along the way. For instance, if somebody had said, you know, I realize that, Bob, I realize that you think this is just going to be abysmally dull, but go take the accounting 101. Just do it for me. Get a C. It's okay.
And I will forever be grateful to my father who forced me to learn to type.
Oh, it's so funny. I type fairly rapidly now. I never took a typing class in my life. My mother begged me to take typing in high school, but Mom, that conflicts with drama 4. Yeah, I had 4 years of drama in high school. No, really? With this show, you think?
And there's one difference between you, between us, and that is I'm female, and so pretty much I was sent to college to find a husband.
Yeah, I was sent to college. I was sent to college to find a purpose in life.
Yeah, I was sent to college to have fun, to study drama, find a husband, and be the queen of the neighborhood. You know, the part time players.
Right, and
I did. I found an architect. And wasn't a bad gig when you come right down.
That's a nice catch.
But
you know, if it pays off, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, my architect's my ex-husband of 30-some years, and he's a sweet guy, and I love him, and we're very fond of each other. We ended up being like favorite cousins. And we talk often. So, and his wife's a lovely person, and I adore her, so
Well, just as a compare and contrast moment, Fancy, consider this. I just told you I had 4 years of drama in high school. This was a high school, and it was no special high school, okay? I mean, it really wasn't. We graduated 247 seniors in my senior year.
Wow.
We had German, French, Spanish, and Latin, and a right-wing riot at the mention of teaching Russian. We had, you know, basic introductory physical sciences, biology, chemistry, biochem, physics, math up through the beginnings of calculus, journalism, all the sports, all the VOTEC stuff we were talking about, and you know, that was pretty much it. But I was able to take drama when and if I wanted it. Now, my daughter is a sophomore who just started second semester, and she was offered a choice of music appreciation or drama, and I said, honey, take the drama. Take the drama class. And they told her she couldn't have it because she was only a sophomore.
My kids signed up for Latin the year that they were teaching second year Latin. They only taught one, you know, they just don't.
But there's not enough room in a, it's a drama class. The more people you have, the more shows you can do, the more stuff you can do.
She's money's getting back and the arts get it.
The arts take it on the chin. And, you know, we are in a serious froth here in my county right now, Fancy, because lo and behold, the all-knowing, all-seeing the State Board of Education in this state has come in and declared our county school system a failure and has basically sent our county school system into a sort of educational receivership where it will be run not by the county elected Board of Education, but by a state functionary who is basically a hatchet man who just came out of ramrodding a consolidated high school down.
So we got to cut funds on you, guy.
Right, and the reason they did this to us is because we had the unmitigated gall to go to the polls and reject wholesale outright a plan that would have taken four out of five of the county's high schools and combined them into one Franken school that would have been nearly a two-hour bus ride away for my kids. And we were punished for participating in the democratic process. And you can't organize people hardly anymore. You can't get them to stand on their hind legs and get good and pissed off and tell somebody to piss up a rope. But I'd love to call for a general strike on the school system here in this county.
And if they don't have skin in the game, you know, I mean, I live down here in Arizona, which is, we're pretty high on the elderly demographics here. And I can't, you know, tell you how many people have said, I don't want any kids in school. What do I care?
Yeah, but of the ones who have kids in school, if you could organize them and say, look.
I keep explaining to these people, if we have better schools, they won't be stealing your hubcaps as often. You know, what improves the community ultimately improves for you.
Right. But the only thing they can see is that they've got a chance to issue a boatload of paper for bonds to build this gigantic, sickening Franken school that will increase dropout rates, will decrease participation. You know, my kids, forget extracurricular activities because it's going to be a 30-mile round trip 5 days a week to pick the kids up after football practice or band practice. So they're going to get on the bus and they're going to come home.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely, it's infuriating. Fancy, it is absolute. I mean, just stand on your head and bark like a dog, maddening.
I don't know. I've always been optimistic that the pendulum swings both ways. And that, well, whatever you're experiencing now, the opposite will be there for you. And so, you know, the old Zen cone about everybody saying this is good and the Zen master saying, is it? You know, or this is bad, and the Zen master saying, is it? But right now, it stinks.
And we're barely treading water. And, of course, the argument put forward in a little county like mine is...
And I sent you about, Fitz is one of my cartoon monuments. He's wonderful. And he does a lot of local, and this was an Arizona cartoon. And it showed that they were balancing the budget on the backs of the elderly, the sick, and the children. And they said, well, we can't get the corporations in here because that would that'd be socialism.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think that's
what a country.
And Arizona's, we're seeing it. We're seeing it in small ways. We're seeing it in the rodeo parade this year will be shorter than it's ever been because we don't have the police force to cover the length of a long rodeo parade.
Yeah, and you probably don't have the infrastructure to shovel up what follows a rodeo parade, but that's nice. Hey, Fancy, I've got to roll on, dear, but it's been a wonderful conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, take care.
Yeah, love to the chat room.
Bye. All right, and bye now. From out in Arizona, that's our dear friend Fancy, and let's see what's going on here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Well, hey, Kevin, what's up?
Nothing much. Next week, I am officially leaving the United States.
Are you really?
Yeah, that's clear.
As of when?
The 24th, but there's still some stuff involved in that because I have to get my visa. But if, put it this way, whatever day it happens, we're gunning for the 24th because I have to be there by the 25th.
Be where?
Seoul, South Korea.
Wow.
By the 26th, if not, the first week in March, definitely. So, it's been quite a journey to get to this point, but I've been offered a position to getting my visa processed, my permanent residency processed. So I'm waiting for the numbers to come. It should come any day now. So, yeah. Hello?
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm listening.
So basically, that whole Detroit situation is just pathetic. It really is. And
you know, we've seen it in other places. God knows, the South Bronx is by no means done or fixed or able or healthy. But the effort is being made. But at this point, everything I read says the middle of Detroit is just being hung out to dry.
Well, that, and also, you see, the thing is with the Bronx and places, like New York is going through the whole revitalization. That's all nice, well, and good, but the reality is, and when a country no longer makes things, you can have all the revitalization, infrastructure jobs, and all that. This country is no longer making things. That's just putting a Band-Aid on the bullet wound. And the bullet wound is that this country doesn't make a damn thing anymore. And that's the bottom line. You can have all the road projects you want. But you want to build roads to do what? The bottom line is that we have to get our manufacturing, our factories rolling, making washing machines, consumer goods, blenders. And those things are not being made here.
Well, and beyond that, the other thing, Kevin, is that we've got Detroit as an example, but as David in Tennessee pointed out to me, that it's just like the Ninth Ward, Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. There are dozens of blocks in Detroit that are bare to the ground and growing weeds. I don't know if you saw that video of the ice house in Detroit, an abandoned house in freezing weather, and they just poured water on it until it turned into this frozen structure.
No, but I wouldn't be surprised. I really wouldn't on what's going on. It's just one of those things where, again, the wild is reclaiming Detroit. And when that's because there's no activity there. And what's so sad about it, that whole area is an apartheid state because you used to see golf courses around Detroit, outside of Detroit.
Oh, yeah, there's still some serious money outside Detroit.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing. It makes Florida look like a the amount of golf courses that I've seen when you fly over it this way. It's just one of those things where, again, no car industry, no cars are being made in America.
It's just so surprising, I suppose, Kevin, to consider that we're able to watch an American city, for the love of God, reduced to ruin literally before our very eyes.
Exactly. And it's not like an atomic bomb landed on it.
No, this is dying from active neglect. And to be fair, it has also been dying as a function of, look, what's the best way to describe this? Way back before Henry Ford got his shtick going, one of the premier wagon factories in the South was in the town that I grew up in Alabama.
Yeah.
And they were put out of business by the horseless carriage.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people lost their jobs in that process. But the... So what you see happening here is the economic transition going on and an absolute failure of any sort of leadership in that area to deal with the fact that maybe one of these days the very soul and existence of Detroit ain't going to be the automobile. And that's why this is happening. Look at Pittsburgh after the collapse of the steel industry, and yet Pittsburgh rebounded beautifully. But it takes absolute determination and vision and a willingness to think beyond the mono economies, and I should know this, I live in one, mono economies never come to good. Mono economies always end badly, Kevin.
Yes, that is true. And also just having an electorate with a public that's educated enough to rein these corporations from leaving easily. One of the reasons why I decided to move to the Republic of South Korea is because, first of all, they make things here. And not just weapons to kill off brown people. They make day-to-day things that normal humans...
They make cars!
They make cars, they make toys, they make clothes. They
electronics?
Electronics. They make things there, so I'll be in an economy where what I buy goes back into the area that I live.
Now, is it? But doesn't South Korea also have a rather authoritarian streak?
They do, because they were a dictatorship until '90, but they're coming out of that and they're becoming more open. Also, there's the issue of race. I've been fortunate because the school district that's hiring me is seeking foreign English-speaking teachers of different races. Before, believe it or not, they only wanted Caucasian teachers. And, like, me being African-American or mixed race, they're making efforts because they're realizing in order to get into the global marketplace, and if you want basically, you know, black dollars, you have to make the steps yourself. And, you know, that's all I ask for. I don't ask for, you know, we are the world, lovey-dovey. Because a lot of that ends up being phony. But it comes to a realization that bigotry is a very weak, one-sided emotion. And it's within your interest not to be bigot. Bottom line. Because that person that you may hate may end up benefiting you one day in the end. You know, so, and that's all I've ever asked for from my fellow man who may or may not care for my presence for whatever reason. You know, so, it's one of those things where you just realize all around how much control over your life you can have if you're educated enough and do your research, which is what I did, you know, regarding South Korea, that I can be in a situation where I can have much greater control over a lot of aspects of my life than I do here. From how I spend my dollars to where my dollars are going to and how the turnaround could benefit me in the end. You know?
Yeah, indeed. Well, so you've got very little time to get a whole bunch of stuff together and ready then, right?
Well, I've been getting ready little by little since the new year because I knew, I said, by March 1st, I'm going somewhere. And I still have China as the backup. So, like, beginning of March, I'm going to be on a plane somewhere. Okay, so...
Well, we want photos, and we want...
You'll definitely get that. You will.
And, you know, I guess you'll be listening on the... you'll be listening on the John Fox plan at that point.
Yeah, but I'm going to try and make an effort to adjust my timing. I could probably get in touch with you. Most likely, I'll be calling you on a Saturday because we're 14 hours ahead.
Right. Yep, you're on the John Fox plan.
Yeah. If I do call into a show live, it would be most likely on a Saturday. So John Fox is 3 hours ahead of me. Soul in Japanese.
Right now. But close enough for government work, as they say. Well, Kevin, it's great to hear the plan, and I look forward to seeing it come into action, and I just, we all wish you the absolute best.
Thank you. You know, and it's like, all kind of leaves with a bit of sadness, too, you know. It's just, if anybody had a reason to stay in the United States, especially in New York, it's me. Because I do love the city. You know, I do love the city. I have a lot of family ties. But it's just, things have become so miserable and all that. You know, and not for me, but just life around me.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just like, I can't stand to see a lot of suffering and, you know,
yeah, weeds. And, yeah, the weeds are getting a little too close.
Yeah, and in spite of, you know, me not really working gainfully in the past 2 years and what have you, I still look pretty well in comparison to a lot of other people. So I'm very fortunate, but it's just, like you said, the weeds are getting a bit too close for me.
Well, shoot us a note, and you know, even if it's just, hey, I'm out of here, let us know, and then we'll wait for the follow up settling in note.
Yeah. And I'll probably call you before I leave.
Okay, cool. Well, Kevin, take care, my friend, and look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, sir.
All right.
See you soon, brother.
All right. Bye. Bye now. Kevin calling from Brooklyn, and one of these days he'll be Kevin calling from South Korea. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Garrett, what's up?
Got another nominee for Moran today.
Oh, Moran Monday nominee? Do please.
It's probably not as good as Evan Bay or any of the others, but apparently Southwest Airlines, they might have an issue with people who are not, shall we say, skinny, because apparently they threw off Kevin Smith, the director, off of an airplane because he was too heavy. But here's the thing. He would have been outraged, but he got bumped because the whole thing is that he had a scheduled flight. He always takes two seats because because he'll admit that he's a fat man. He's made a career out of it, trust me. And two, he just, like, you know, likes the empty seat to have, you know, to spread out and all that and have his gear right by him. But so anyway, they offered him. He's returning home from the Macworld Expo last weekend. And he has a, you know, he wants to get home a little bit quicker to see his wife. So he's like, can I upgrade? It's like, okay. You know, it's like, be like, and he's all like, okay, I want to upgrade. There's this, you can, but there might be only one seat left. He's like, okay. And I was like, sits down waiting for this word. He's like, did they realize that I'm kind of, you know, did they look at me? Did they realize that I'm kind of fat? Because he wasn't enthused with the service. So he goes back up and he kind of reconfirms at the desk by the, you know, by the gate. And it's like, everything's okay, sir. So it's like, and then they let him on the plane, and then somebody approaches him on the tarmac, you know, the tunnel down to the plane, and says something about revenue. And then as he hasn't even sat down between these two skinny ladies, you know, hasn't even started to buckle up the seatbelt, and they pull him off, and the person at the desk tells him that you need to get off, and it's because of a security risk. And it's like, he's like, huh? So they get him off the plane, and he's like, what type of a, he's getting upset, and he's like, what type of a security risk? It's like, is it because of, and it's like, the captain said that he saw you and decided that you were some sort of a security risk. And then it dawns on him. This is because I'm fat, isn't it? He's like, those are your words, not mine. So, basically.
Yeah, that's the yeah, but answer, right.
Yeah. So he's like,
oh my God. Well, I remember this. I forget which airline it was a while back, Garrett, that was going to start charging extra for extra, you know, for people with extra. Welcome to the world we live in.
But there's more.
Oh.
There's more.
Oh. It's a Ginsu commercial.
Yeah. So anyway, he has his phone, and as he's doing this, he's using his iPhone to contact Twitter, and Twitter's blowing up because, you know, he's Kevin Smith. He has tons of fanboys. So of course he has followers and they're all doing it. But he's not aware that it's going that crap crazy. But he does mention he's complaining that it's like, you know, among other things, I'm kind of sort of a journalist of sorts. You know, I've got a following and all. It's like, you know, people that know of me will hear of this. So they, you know, the manager, because he eventually called over the manager. The manager eventually comes over, you know, it's like, ask him for $100 credit. It's like, no, I'm not taking a $100 credit for this inconvenience. So it's like, he goes away, and then this manager comes back and is like, we're very sorry.
Good God, this guy has 1.6 million Twitter followers.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might be interested to know that I just typed Kevin Smith into the Google.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing, you know how it fills stuff in for you? Well, the first thing up was Kevin Smith Southwest.
Oh, yeah, because this is new. This is part of the story. So, anyway, you know, it's all, you know, he's released his very angry series of twits out into the ether, and you know, then the manager comes out and is like, we're really sorry about this, can you accept this as an apology, blah blah, you know, and $100, and it's like no, and we're going to investigate it, and it's like, there's nothing to investigate, I told you what happened. And you know, so it's like, you know, so basically he ends up going on a later flight, which is probably basically the one that he had intended to do, because he was so furious. He was thinking about driving from San Francisco to the L.A. area, you know, but he decided against it because he realized that idea to drive mad. Two, he'd probably, you know, just stop every 3 minutes.
And I love the way that Hollywood thinks, because some people now are accusing him, based on the research that I've done while as we've been talking. They're saying that this is just a promotional stunt because his new movie's about to open.
But I love his
response to it, tweeting. Sometimes it baffles me how little people think things through. And then he tweeted, free publicity equals 200 new articles declaring I'm fat. Yay me, epic win.
Yeah, that sounds about right, because he's like, you know, I know I'm fat, but he doesn't need the, you know, yeah, kind of in the same boat. It's been, Jesus, 5.5 years since I was last on the airplane, but he's in the same situation as me.
Well, look, I mean, okay.
Yeah.
I was, it was the Monday that we had the meeting, with Governor Manchin, and we all, and because of parking problems over at the Governor's Mansion, Manchin's Mansion, by the way, just in case you thought I was repeating myself or speaking, getting confused. No, it was Governor Manchin's Mansion. Anyway, we all drove to where we met up, Shoney's, and then we all got in cars to come on over the rest of the way. And so I was getting in, my buddy Bo's car, and he's got this, this cute little Mazda hatchback affair. It's a real scooter. I mean, it gets and goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting in the passenger seat, and I had on a suit, and I had on a wool overcoat over me. And Bo just looks over at me and goes, "Bob Kincaid, you are a big son of a bitch." And I said, "Well, I'm carrying probably 50 more than I ought to." He goes, "No, you're just big." And, you know, I was I had to change planes. I flew from here to D.C. and from D.C. to Albany a couple of years back now. It was exactly a couple of years back. And I swear, the second plane I got on, the first wasn't much better, but it was one of those turboprop, de Havilland.
A little rinky dink one.
Yeah, but, you know, there was a little bit of room. But I got on this little commuter jet in D.C. to go to Albany. And, you know, I remember coming back and saying, I swear, I think that, who was it? Forget which airline, U.S. Scare. I think U.S. Scare got it from, they bought it on a lease and buyback, from Hobbiton Airlines. Cause mine, honest to God, and you know, I'm 6'2 and 200 and too many pounds, okay? 48 long suit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, not gravid or, you know, morbid, but big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting on that aircraft with my knees under my chin, almost in crash position, without any opportunity, you know, and not because I expected to crash, but because that's what I was squeezed into. And again, it's a function of the press for the American economic press for maximizing the dollar over any human value whatsoever.
And so,
you know, when Southwest gets hold of the wrong fat guy, good for Kevin Smith. Good for him.
But there's still more.
Oh, my God. We're getting so it's not just the Ginsu and the paring knife. We're getting the apple peeler.
Oh, yeah. So, anyway, he gets on the plane. He has the one seat, and since it goes back, it's a less full flight, so it goes back to him having his two seats that he started out with. One, you know, on the side that's like where he sits, and the other one's empty. So down sits, in the third seat in the row, sits down a woman, and apparently she's, you know, large, you know. So, and they sit down, they, you know, say hi and all that, and then she gets, you know, pulled away for a few moments, and then she comes back, and it's like, you know, Smith's like, huh, okay, and it's like, and then they get to talking, and they try to, what it boiled down to, and it's the same person that gave him trouble, because it's still in San Francisco, is like, you might want to consider buying a second seat. They told her you might want to consider buying a second seat. Knowing that the second seat is empty right next to her.
Oh, God.
Yes. So he's outrageously furious. And it's because Kevin Smith runs a podcast. He usually has it. The whole thing was to have it with the guy that produced, Scott Mosier, who's produced all of Kevin Smith's movies with him, and is one of his good friends. But it's had his friends, he's had his daughter, he has his mother, and of course he's had his wife on. So they do a podcast. As soon as he gets home, he records the podcast and you know, he posted it last night with the title F-U Southwest Airlines, and it's the whole over an hour, and it's like this whole story, and it's just like, oh my God, absolutely epic. And the thing is that the point to emphasize is that if Kevin Smith's wife had been there, that would have been a real scene. Because he's saying that, you know, she's just getting, you know, like upset, you know, at this, you know, just at the first part. She's just saying that she would have been absolutely bat-crap crazy at the first part. But then all this other stuff, just absolutely, she would have gone flying off the handle, because Smith, the thing that set him off is that this other woman, you know, that they did the same, tried to do the same thing to this other woman on a non-packed flight. I mean, which just says it's a pattern of practice.
You know what? I love it. They just picked on the wrong big dude.
Yeah, basically, because, I mean, you know.
So I guess to time travel a little bit, Orson Welles wouldn't be welcome in first class either.
Oh, probably. Well, the thing is Southwest doesn't have, I don't know if you've ever flown.
William Conrad? How about Raymond Burr? Without the wheelchair?
Probably not. I mean, the thing is that Southwest has no first class per se. It's all just, you know, catch as catch can.
Right.
They're kind of free. I flown south when I was in college doing, instead of driving between Vegas and Reno, that's how I'd go, is a freaking cheap, you know, cheap ticket between there when school came back on. And it was just like, you know, it's never before had problems with that, because Kevin Smith goes there because they have a hub in the Burbank Airport, which is closer to his house, and plus, you know, has amenities, and besides, it's not LAX, you know, which of course is a freaking nut house of an airport, you know, so it's like, it's why they use it. And it's like, they had earlier, Smith's wife even said, I just bought like a crap ton of tickets for Southwest earlier in the week. It's like because he does these appearances where he chats with fans and, you know, talks about.
Yeah, well, I mean, and, you know, considering the way he's leveraged social networking and blogging and podcasting and all of that stuff, the guy is obviously on the cutting edge of figuring out how to reach people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, my God, I can't get my Twitter followings up to, I can't get my Twitter followings past 100.
Well, yeah, I mean, he made a couple of cult movies before the internet days, and he just, you know, what can you say? He did, you know, he made good movies, and, you know, he realized what was, you know, the cutting edge, and was on top of it. He made a website way before anybody. He did his first website, you know, pretty early.
You know, it makes me wonder, would Arnold be allowed in Kevin Smith's spot? You know, there's a living guy who ain't exactly a shrinking violet.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's awesome. I mean, but the thing is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is recognizable to anybody. I mean, because...
Yeah, so Kevin Smith is just appears to be a nondescript, overweight schlub.
Yes, and he'll even admit to it. I mean, you know, this.
Well, look, if you're James Cameron and you can't get off the plane without some guy who's hoping to sell some piece of crap on eBay trying to get you to sell a poster, I'm thinking Kevin Smith is ahead of the game where that's concerned.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, this movie that he has coming out, it's the first one he's directed where he's never written, but it's because it's starring Bruce Willis, because he had a cameo on the last Die Hard movie, and he and Willis got along great, and Willis was like, you want to direct the movie, like my next movie or whatever? Willis like, sure, just like, because he's a child of the late 70s and 80s just like me, and Bruce Willis is, well, Bruce Willis.
Yeah, and know? It's being pointed out to me that Arnold is only 5'10".
Yeah, but he's, I mean, that's the thing. He's not, he's just bulky, I guess is the thing. But again, it's, he's, Kevin Smith isn't, is, he has a cult fame, but he's not, you know, instantly recognizable. Because at first he thought it was some jerkwad who hated his movies or hated some, you know, because he shoots from the hip.
Yeah.
I mean, he, that's his thing. I mean, you know, this, and all of that. And it's like, but, you know, that once he encountered this other woman, he's like, holy crap. And that's when the outrage, the legitimate outrage started. And that's why it's, I called in for more A Monday on it, because it's,
well, I think the winner for Moran Monday on the corporate level. Do you realize how far Moran Monday has expanded, Garrett? We've got individual Moran Monday, and now we've got corporate Moran Monday nominations.
And we have the Hall of Fame.
And yes, we have what of Mussolini's can we retire? We're retiring her Moran glasses, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, her.
Yeah.
I swear someday they'll get those, pry those glasses from her, and they'll be revealed to just be, you know, panes of glass like they use in the movies.
Well, you know, there's that old blonde joke, and having once been a blonde, I don't mind telling them. There's that old blonde joke that about the blonde that was walking around with the, always had earphones on, and mm-hmm. one day and everybody was curious because, you know, why is the blonde always wearing the earphones? Why is the blonde always wearing the earphones? I wonder what's always playing in there. And one day somebody at work walks up to the blonde and takes the earphones out, and the blonde just drops dead. And they take the earphones up and put them to their ears, and they hear, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out.
Oh, God. That's so evil.
Yeah.
Funny, but evil.
Yeah. But at any rate, I'm going to roll on. Awfully good hearing from you, Garrett, and thank you for your nomination.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
You too, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye.
And somewhere along the way, I've got to find time for our governmental, well, no, that's just general individual Moran, but I got a Moran nomination for tonight we got to get to, but we got to keep rolling through the phones as it goes. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. I hate to follow a caller heavyweight like Garrett, but I couldn't help.
Oh, nice pun, Brian. Nice pun. Heavyweight.
Nice pun, that's right.
Kevin Smith. Yeah, right.
It's not like the next one. You're not going to say about the next story I have to tell her, but I couldn't help cracking up about a story I heard. Oh, my God. It fits right in with Kevin's call before. That God love you, Kevin. Good luck in Korea there. It's great. I remember before I went in the Marine Corps, like I said, there was a kid from South Korea there, and I was basically a runaway just getting by as a dishwasher in Los Angeles, Hollywood. And he had to, in order to, what was it? I would teach him English, and in return for that, he was teaching me Taekwondo, which is Korean karate or martial arts, a very rough version of martial arts, Korean Taekwondo. And, but he was going even at 25%, 30% speed, this big Korean kid. He's a good kid, but he was beating the crap out of me. So we had to switch to, he was paying me about $2.50 an hour for the English lessons at that time instead of the so-called Taekwondo lessons. I couldn't survive them. And that's what, you know, from Korea, it is a great country. They are great people. But in the same line, talking about the plane flight with Kevin Smith, the director.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but talking about a real large man that had to take a plane flight, a long plane flight back from, back from Asia from a wrestling tour in Japan. This is a story according to the great wrestler Killer Kowalski. Haystack Callahan or Haystack Calhoun, whatever his name, 640-pound wrestler.
Oof.
They couldn't really fit him on the passenger flight. You know, they gave him like three seats of his own or his own own wing of the plane, basically, or his own. But you know, on those long plane flights, though, you have to relieve yourself at some time. And, you know, the Johns on that plane, they're too small even for a barely above average built guy or gal there, you know, they're really too small as they are. But for a 640-pound professional wrestler, but he had to relieve himself in all ways. So they had to get a mailbag to let Killer Kowalski go back to the plane there.
Ew.
And it's a very crappy story, I know. I'm sorry. I'll go on from there.
Oh, you're batting a million tonight.
Oh, okay, great. But I just been talk about another crappy, about filmmaking, too. For the first time, Bob, I saw it. I got on an old VHS tape there. The first two Godfather movies by Francis Ford Coppola, they're masterful. They're like Greek tragedies.
Aren't they?
American story. But then I finally saw last night Godfather 3. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was, you know, Michael Corleone's character, they were still great, great actors, great cast still. Eli Wallach turned out to be the bad guy, the bad Don, I guess, against the Corleone family. But in the end there, you know, his God love her, she's a beautiful girl, young actress. I believe this movie was made about 1990. Sophia Coppola, you know, the daughter of the film director. So
yes.
She's beautiful, but very charming in the scenes and all that, too. She played the daughter, one of the daughters, Anthony, and I forget her Mary or whatever, the name of Michael Corleone. You know, they had grown up by then. It was set in 1979. And he brought this Kay Adams back, you know, there as his former wife, and she came, and they were visiting Sicily to try to get away from all the mob hits and all that in New York City and the rest of they were continuing. But what happened was, in the final scene there of the movie, the tragedy of Michael Corleone, it looks like he's the hitman, the Sicilian professional hit guy, he gets him, it looks like he's got him too, but the bullet, the shot's gone through the high-powered shotgun, really. You would know about this stuff better than me, but it goes right, God love her, it goes through his daughter's body. You know, she's shot and she's fatally wounded. She looks at him and says, Dad, you know, and she falls. It's a tragic scene, and he cries out like, and, you know, he says, oh, God, forgive me. Oh, God, forgive me. And he goes, before that, he had gone to into the Vatican itself or he was visiting Rome and Sicily at the same time, their power base, the Vatican Bank. It was part of the whole
story. Oh, yeah.
He had the story. It wasn't an effective movie at all to me. I was thinking that this Michael Corleone character, as they were going through all these silly scenes there, Andy Garcia, yeah, he was effective and all that too as the new heavy to take over as the new young Don eventually. But there's still a... I was thinking, I kept wanting to call Michael Corleone, you know, Al Pacino's character, I want to call him Shecky Corleone all through the movie, because he just wasn't, he looked like he wasn't taking the premise of
the movie. The whole movie was mailed in.
Yeah, it was a beautiful stuff, beautiful photography, and a beautiful...
It's a Who reunion concert.
The technical, no matter what story he's going to tell, yeah. But the fact was, in that final scene, that he cries, he also confessed to the man that would become the future pope there, set in 1979, but it wasn't set around where, you know, the big Polish lad who I still miss as pope there, Pope John. You know, I don't like this Hitler Jugend guy, I don't even respect him as a pope. He's the guy that hit all the child molesting demons, this Benedict bastard. But anyways, this guy, this Italian guy, becomes the Pope. He's the guy that Michael Corleone confesses to, that I ordered the murder of my own brother, my mother's own son, and my father's own son. I had to murder
Frank Pluto.
And he confesses to this priest, and he says, well, it's an evil thing you've done. And the Italian, and the opera and all that, they're very operatic, even when they're having conversation. But in the final scene there is set in an opera house, and what happens is, you know, Anthony is one of is like the lead singer. He's a great opera singer and all that too. Is it beautiful?
Any
other kind of opera but Italian opera to me? I don't know.
Come on. Mozart, please. Wagner?
Opera, yeah.
Yeah, I'll get hate mail from Eugene Finnerman for mentioning Wagner.
Wagner, okay, that kind of that's very metaphysical opera, though. It's not really the human...
No. Aren't they doing Pagliacci in The Godfather? Isn't that what it is? With the clown suit and
No, not Pagliacci. Oh, no. This is, it's set in, I forget what the opera was that they were, doing, but in the end, in the opera house scene there, the final scene there, his daughter is fatally, wounded, by the killer there, this Sophia Coppola, and she was, I guess because he's her father, you know, talk about Italian fathers babying their kids, especially their daughter, she would not speak up through, I kept wanting to, speak up, kid, will you, with the scenes there, with the conversation about a $100 million fund is made in her name for the poor people of Italy, but the Vatican Bank naturally steals the...
Well, you know, no. When the girl winds up getting the cap busted in her in Godfather 3, it reminds me of what Oliver Wilde said about the death of Little Nell Dickens's.
Well, Oscar Wilde, what
Oscar Wilde said about the death of Little Nell in Dickens's Oliver Twist.
Okay.
He said anybody who could not laugh at that has no soul.
Okay. Yeah, he was a great critic too. That. Oscar Wilde, but the fact is, yeah, that this scene there, she just would not speak up. He would not raise the audio tone or just tell her to speak up because of maybe she's his only daughter and he can't, in front of everybody else in this huge movie, said he can't criticize his own daughter, a real Italian father. So that's part of the tragedy too, of this Italian making this movie about this criminal Italian family, this great Italian artist.
Yeah, but you know, it just so happens that The Godfather 2 was running on cable last night.
Oh, that's a beautiful. That's a great movie.
Yeah, there was a commentator who came along during one of the commercial breaks, and explained something that was really delightfully profound, Brian. And okay. That was he said, you know, Coppola has built a huge food and wine business in the course of also being a director.
Oh, sure.
And he said it parallels very nicely with the fact that as the Corleone crime family is rising, they're also, you know, they're an olive oil business, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Cool olive oil, yeah.
Right. And he said, if you sit down and you get serious about the, you know, and everybody always says, the first two Godfather movies. It's like no one wants to admit ever even having seen Godfather 3.
And you know where, you know, Michael does order that hit on Fredo there where they're fishing out there in Lake Tahoe with little Anthony. And that's part of Francis Ford Coppola's own story. He went fishing with his own uncle, and he would pray. He would pray the Hail Marys and the Stations of the Cross before, and he caught 20 fish, but nobody else in the boat caught a damn fish.
I'll be darned. Well, the neat thing that this critic brought forward is he said, while it's a brilliant couple of films and absolutely engaging, and you just can't turn away from it, he said, by the same token, what Coppola did is he took the mafia organization as
criminality
as a model, but what he did is he painted a broad stroke picture of capitalism.
Yeah, that's true too. Absolutely, and that you find it at its absolute most excessive in this 1979 setting, but the rest of the storyline, of course, is not nearly as strong as Godfather 1 and 2. But the fact is, then I'll let you go on to the other callers there, Bob, but the fact is, I was with the same Michael Corleone, in the end, you think he's killed fatally, but then there's another fatal scene there, at one of the final shots there, camera shots in Godfather 3. You know where like Marlon Brando dies in the garden, and he kind of drops dead himself as a really an old man. Father, he was about 60. That Michael Corleone set in this 1979 character, but what happens outside the opera house? He cries out like he did to the priest there too. He cries out, "God forgive me for my life, for my devil's life. God forgive me. You send me to death. These infernal bring back my daughter. God forgive me." I wanted to cry out too. Part of my own Catholic guilt there was just because the Catholic sense of things. I believe in the Saint, like we were talking about last week, the Saint Thomas More, the Catholic sense of being liberal and universal and devoted to the arts and even to the sciences, where I believe in evolution. that fact of the thing, I felt like crying out to. I was saying, "Dear God, why I used to be a serious film critic. Why did I watch this movie? What? Forgive me for watching this celluloid piece of crap." It was worse than what Haystack Calhoun put into that metal bag of that plane there, Bob. That was what Francis worked up with. How could he do it to us?
Oh, and you brought the thing full circle, Brian.
Save us all. But good luck to you, Kevin, in Korea. God love you, what?
Indeed,
night,
indeed.
Bob.
Brian, take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Wow. talk about closing the loop. Oh, and yeah, in the chat room, Garrett's just noted, the last shot of Godfather 3 is the goofiest thing ever. And yeah, it is, and it's only, I don't know, I'm not sure which is goofier, Jar Jar Binks or the final scene of Godfather 3. You know, pick one. Personally, I think Jar Jar Binks was a better actor than Sophie Coppola, but you know, who the hell am I? She did go on to make she did a wonderful job as a director in Lost in Translation. That's one of my favorite films, but Godfather 3. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
Bob.
Yes.
Bob.
Yes.
Bob.
What have I done?
Elmer Fudd.
Oh, yeah, well.
That is perfect, Bob.
You like my Elmer Fudd?
Oh, it fits my perfectly. I sat here laughing my head off. You got to keep doing that, Bob.
Oh, well, you know, maybe that's our whiny Dino voice.
I mean, that was just perfect because the man is such a creep.
Yes. Well, there you go. You just put it right out of the park. What? How do I respond to the fact that Evan Bayh is a, yes, he is.
He is a creep. All this other stuff came down. Oh, we've got to go more to the right. Yeah, you already been there, man.
Ben lives.
Yeah.
I mean, What is there about Evan Bayh that even seems remotely related to any principle for which the Democratic Party is allegedly supposed to stand for?
Of course. And they say his dad was really left wing. I don't know, but I said if he was, he's rolling over in his grave.
Wasn't that Birch Bayh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was kind of respectable.
Yeah. But, you know, we're talking about what Obama said about him. You know, he was even being considered for vice president, and I thought, oh my God.
Oh, I remember that. I was just, you know, yeah. The idea. So.
I mean, and it, even just the way he talks, he doesn't hardly open his mouth. You know, he's kind of lets them just slide out or something.
I have a feeling the Democrats are quickly trying to screw themselves right out of their majority, and
yeah,
you know, as long as 41 Republicans are enough to stop the Senate dead in its tracks, what's 50 or 51 Democrats?
Right.
Yeah, and because I think the Democrats will hold on to 50 or 51 seats, and maybe with only 51 seats, they'll get serious about passing some legislation.
I'll tell you, I don't know. I just don't know. We'll have to see what we shall see.
And I realize I will probably spit on the ground and curse Juanita when it comes true and we see what the real outcome of it is. But what have we lost if Harry Reid loses his Senate seat? What have we lost?
Well, I hope they don't get another one like him, you know, because I don't think...
No, it'll be a Republican.
I don't think he... Well, but even if we had them in charge.
Oh, I thought you meant, no, I thought you meant they as in Nevada. No, Nevada would elect a Republican to the Senate, so they'd have John Ensign and him.
Well,
but as far as who would rise to be Senate Majority Leader, Dick Durbin?
Is that I hope it wouldn't be somebody like him, because I think Daschle was the same thing.
Oh, Daschle was an absolute doormat milksop, sure.
Too.
Yeah. No, we need somebody.
We need somebody with blood and guts.
You know, it could never be Bernie Sanders because he's not a Democrat.
No.
So he's not a member of the majority. He just caucuses with him.
It's going to be this way or that way.
You know, Russ Feingold. You know,
I'd rather have him.
Al Franken hasn't been in the Senate long enough to get that kind of stature. Maybe a Jack Reed. I don't know. Somebody with some fire in the belly. Maybe.
I don't either. You know,
how about the first female Senate Majority Leader? Debbie Stabenow, Michigan.
Maybe. maybe. Barbara Boxer would be better.
Yeah, of course, she's running.
I want that other one from California.
Yeah, she's running for her life right now, Barbara Boxer is. But, yeah, she'd be a good one.
I don't know. My mind's a blank on that.
Well, mine stays that way, Juanita,
really,
so don't feel bad.
You know, I really haven't thought it out, but not anymore. You know, I know they can't help the way they talk, but when you have the actions that goes along with the sound of your voice, it makes it even worse.
Yeah, when your actions betray the fact that even if, that you've got an Elmer Fudd mindset, yeah.
I love it. Bob, you've got to keep doing that one. That is perfect. That is one of the best.
Well, we got two votes for my screwy little voices tonight. We got a vote for Elmer Fudd and a vote for my Michael Savage impression.
Oh, that was good too. Yeah, but that other one was, you know, you've done it before. This was like a shock. You know, it shocked me into laughing my head off. My head's laying over on the floor.
Oh, I got a question for you, Juanita. What would happen if some Democrat or some liberal commenter referred to, and we're not talking about me because I'm just mean, but somebody in the mainstream, say Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann, what would happen if they referred to Dick Cheney or George Bush as a drunken Irishman? Don't you imagine the Irish American Anti-Defamation Committee would be up in arms demanding an apology?
Yeah.
That there would just be absolutely hell to pay.
Of course.
Well, guess what?
What?
That skinny blonde guy that goes by the name of Ann Coulter. has now officially referred to the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, as a drunken Irishman 20 million times less qualified than Sarah Palin.
Oh, boy.
You know, I don't think there's any sense in entering Man Coulter in Moran Monday because, well, yeah. Man Coulter just is.
Yep. Yes, she is. Yeah. I'm wanting to talk to you, too, about, about seeing the Scottish investigation of the Iraqi war.
Mm-hmm.
And they were questioning Tony Blair. Well, last week I saw, do you remember that the lady, the secretary that resigned a couple of years after the war had started? She was a secretary of I think the money or whatever. I have her name written down.
Yeah, because I can't take it off the tip of my tongue.
Do you remember that?
I remember the circumstances. Yes.
Her name was Claire Short.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I found it. They interviewed her the other day, and it would blow your mind.
Really?
Oh yeah. She was telling why she quit. And she said that Tony Blair was just going along with the Americans. She's talking about how the Americans, you know, they were trying to work things out with in the United Nations with France and so forth. And she believed that France would have come around, but we were spouting off over here against UN and everything else. And she even brought up about the Freedom Prize. But you would just have to see it. I would recommend it. I'm going to tell you, that woman, she said they went in unprepared. They didn't have enough of equipment or anything, that they needed to wait. And she believed that France eventually would have come in to help. But it might have circumvented everything if they had have waited. But you remember, Bush was about to have a hissy fit to get over there. He wanted to get over there before he did get over there. But this woman, this is so interesting, and she's not like somebody, yeah, you know, she's just stating the facts. And she said that England did not need to be doing America's bidding just because they thought they had to. She said, but well, you know how they came out and said that Blair was Bush's puppy dog.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes. The Bush's poodle, was that it?
Yeah. And basically the way she's talking, that's basically what it was. It's like he wouldn't listen to anybody over there. He was only listening to over here. But I can't really tell it how good it is, but it is something to listen to her. To talk about how, and I know people, you know, said that our troops ran out of bullets and something to drink and everything when they got into Baghdad. In the shock and awe.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about that they could have took a little more time to supply them correctly and put more thought. She said they kept saying we would be greeted as heroes. Remember?
Yep.
Be throwing flowers of greetings. But I remember when, you remember when they took down that statue of, what's his name? The one that was the head of the country.
Yeah. Oh, you mean Saddam? Yeah, that little set piece.
Anyway, I remember watching that, and one of the Iraqis said on tape, said, okay, now you've come and you're getting rid of Saddam. Now go home and let us take back over our country.
Right.
Boy, what a sad state of affairs.
Indeed.
But Claire Short, she is my hero.
Well, I'll have to chase this down and see if I can't spend a little.
It'd be on C-SPAN, and you know you can get it online.
Right.
They're going to have more on there. I haven't seen any more. But both of the programs, I just happened to, you know, happen upon them. And, like I said, it just, you know, the things that we believe are true and we've come to know are true, you'll know even more things are true that you believed were true.
Yeah.
The proof is in a lot of what she says.
And, of course, she was absolutely ignored, as were...
She was ignored, and she told of some others that were ignored, you know, that they would find out things later, you know. But she finally, she quit. I remember her quitting. I didn't know who she was. But she's very fine-spoken, you know, well-spoken and all. And, but it's a tragedy, Bob.
Well, it most assuredly. And look, the tragedy continues. I'm sure you've probably seen this by now, but I guess as of Friday, we were discussing the fact that the great big military push with a government in a box coming behind it is on in Afghanistan. I don't know how you describe it. The firefight started, and then we promptly rocketed a home and killed 10 people, at least 5 of them children.
That was it, in Afghanistan.
Yeah, in Afghanistan.
Yeah. I didn't see that. I haven't.
General Stanley McChrystal sent a note of apology to that corrupt former oil executive, Hamid Karzai, saying, "We deeply regret this tragic loss of life."
Yeah. So
you know, why bother?
Yeah, right. So
I hope you understand, Juanita. I'm not being cynical about the loss of life. I'm being cynical about the fact that we send out statements that say, "We tragically regret this tragically loss of life." We don't. We don't, because if we didn't want the loss of life, we would get out of that godforsaken country and let the people there do what they want to do. They had, you know, if
if Americans have a right of self-determination, and that's open for debate at this point, then so too do the Afghans. And, you know, their only right is not the right to have the government that we demand they have. It's a dangerous world.
Yes, it is.
I mean, I'll be the first to say that. And if you put on your white T-shirt with the American flag and an eagle with a big old bald eagle with a, I don't know, some little brown person clutched in its beak, and you go marching into Afghanistan singing singing Onward Christian Soldiers, you're going to get what's coming to you.
Oh, boy, Bob, I'll tell you.
I mean, well, am I wrong?
No. I mean, you're totally right. I totally agree with you.
Unless I missed the memo and somebody has declared us God Almighty of the world, not have the right, Juanita.
Well, that's what a lot of people, I really think, really believe. They believe that we are that, and we're not.
And, you know, it's sad because just reading the New York Times account of this story just makes you shake your head and feel sick because there were a bunch of Marines there who were, you know, they were taking heavy, accurate, small arms fire, it's reported, from this mud hut. Okay?
Yeah.
And they were returning fire. You know, they were doing what Marines do.
Right.
And then the rocket barrage started up. And they hit the house next to it and watch little children start streaming into the street, And, you know, one of the, the story says, more than a half hour later, after the fighting had subsided again, the HIMARS rocket barrage struck a nearby house, but not the one from which highly accurate fire had been holding the Marines against the wall. Several Marines cursed. The wrong building had been hit. The company commander saw the children stream outside, ordered a ceasefire, and sent a patrol to go help. So, in other words, it screwed up. The Marines are exposed to even greater danger in order to go and clear up the mess that the rocketry barrage had done.
Yeah.
You know. This is no way to run a war. This is no way to run a railroad. And frankly, I'm flummoxed, Juanita.
I don't know.
I'm flummoxed because unless we want to do the kinds of things that were done 4,000 years ago, where you simply come in and round up everybody in the country and send them 1,000 miles away and then repopulate the damn place with your own people, this has no end.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, they can talk about, you know, wanting to negotiate with the Taliban. About what? Whose country is it?
Right.
What is it for us? What is for us to negotiate with another country about that country's right to self-determination? Look, nobody hated the Taliban more than I did. Making women walk around in beekeeper suits and female circumcision and then to blow up a 2,000-year-old statues of the Buddha in the Bamiyan Valley. You know, to hell with that bunch, frankly. But it ain't none of my business. It is none of my business. Now, the World Heritage part, that's my business. But you know what? If the women don't want to wear beekeeper suits, they need to go out, and this from a nonviolent guy, they need to go out and start slitting a few husbands' throats in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you know what? That beekeeper business will end right quick.
Yeah. Well, today I went and got blood work, and the lady running the whole place, she was running the whole shebang, she had on the Muslim hood, you know, around her head.
Oh, what is that, an abaya? Yeah. Well, and you know, Islam
was,
is...
And she was running that place by herself. She had it down to a science.
Yeah, and let's be
let's be
clear. Islam is not the only I don't know what problem religion has with the human head, especially with women's heads.
Well, you've got women's. Remember, the women especially in the Catholic Church, they were supposed to cover their heads.
Absolutely. You've got the Catholic tradition of head covering
and
for women.
Yeah.
You've got a Jewish tradition of head covering for women. Dirty, dirty head! And you've got a Muslim tradition for women covering their heads. And I don't know.
But, I mean, that's okay. You know what?
And you've also got Saul, you know, Paul, a.k.a. Saul, that's how he'd appear on the police blotter, telling, you know, women to, you know, don't show your filthy, nasty, sexual desire-inducing hair. I think we got some seriously hung-up people forming the major early parts of the major religions of the world.
Yeah. Well, maybe in those times that was, you know, like I said, at the turn of the 20th century, when they showed a little bit of ankle, it would drive men wild because.
Yeah, but that's a. But how is that the woman's fault if some horn dog guy can't control himself because he just got a glimpse of ankle?
Yeah.
Oh, geez, I think I saw the knob of her collarbone. I shall commit rape.
Tradition.
Well, all these things are grounded in fundamental male sexual insecurity, Juanita. It just is. It's a bunch of guys being afraid that theirs isn't as big as the other guys is. And I'm not trying to be embarrassing here, but all of that, every bit of that garbage that is directed toward women is a manifestation. And you don't have to be Sigmund Freud whacked out of your mind on cocaine to figure this out. It's a manifestation of male sexual inadequacy. Because and it's all wrapped up in biology and in the necessity of the male within the species, and it's stuff that we are just not prepared to get over or around, and it is a plague upon us.
Well, you know, I think in this country now, men are afraid to show. A lot of men are afraid to show emotion toward another man.
Oh.
Because they're afraid of how it will appear. Now, my daddy, he would hug you, male or female, if he liked you, you know. And I remember after I got married and my husband and I came down for a visit, and he'd never been hugged by a man, and my daddy came up and hugged him, and he was like, what in the world, you know, hugged him goodbye, you know. But then from then on, he expected it. But my daddy was like, you see a lot of the old world people, you know, where they hug one another. And I think that causes a lot of problems here in this country. That causes, you know, because the man's got to be the man. But what is a man? There used to be a song that I wish I could find out what it was, but they used to play it on the radio down here when I was a kid, over and over. It was a country song called When I Get Sissy Enough to Wear. One of them was Dad Burned Old Wristwatch. I'll go right out behind the barn and blow my brains out, because he wouldn't be a man then, see? That's how things have changed.
Right.
Okay, and another, he said that I'd take a dad burn bath every Saturday night. I'll go behind the old red barn and shoot my brains right out. It just goes on and on like that, all these things, and you think, what's wrong with that? Well, back in some days, especially in this country, that's the way they felt. Well, if you wore a wristwatch, you weren't a man. You weren't a real man.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so I think, you know, well, that's getting into a lot of psychological.
And that's what I'm saying.
And so forth. But I really think I'm.
If a woman give, well, it's all about progeny and who's the daddy and who's the alpha male and. Whose genes are getting passed on. If a woman gives birth to a child, she's got a pretty good idea who the father is, and she certainly knows who the mother is.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay. But, you know, barring DNA testing, and certainly this goes to 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, the guy don't know. You got to wait a few years and see if, you know, is the eye color the same? Does he look like me? Is he that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The guy has no way of knowing. And there is so much religious tomfoolery wrapped up in that fact.
Yes.
Oh, I've got to make sure and pass the estate on to, you know, he's got to be the, and you know, the law develops the hinks and kinks about this, and concepts of heirs of the body versus a plain heir, and legal heirs as opposed to natural children. You know, in Shakespeare's time, to be called natural meant one of two things. You are either a bastard or a moron.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's...
Well, see, that shows how words have changed in their meanings.
Right.
It used to be all trees were pear trees, all, you know, that bore fruit.
Right.
They were pear trees.
Well, consider the fact that the word corn existed in English before 1492, and they just applied the word corn to maize because, you know, once again, we're not going to call it what the natives called it. We're going to call it what we've decided it is.
Yeah.
Where did
corn come from? The name.
It meant grain.
Oh, okay.
Remember Jesus by the side of the road picking corn? And he got grief for plucking corn on the Sabbath?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, yeah, trust me, them weren't roasting ears.
in your mind, isn't it?
And corned beef?
Yeah.
To corn is a process that involves using salt in large grains that resemble grain?
Yeah.
But, no, well, it, you know, wheat was taken and barley was taken, but corn was just out there, and it was sort of euphemistic and generic. So, hey, that incredible stuff that's going to wind up being the food supply for the entire planet after we get done depopulating these two continents of all the natives that here that know so much more than we do, we're going to call that corn.
Oh.
Wow, where did I get that from? But, yeah, exactly. Juanita, I got to roll, but this has been a wonderful conversation.
Okay, you take care, and what's up, Doc?
I'll try to remember to do that once in a while.
Okay, not.
Later, Juanita. Bye.
Bye.
Juanita calling in from Central Florida on this Moran Monday. Yeah, and a couple of nominations, by the way. A couple of more nominations rolled in over the course of the program, and I want to get to them. Captain Mary, down Memphis way. Oh, I love Memphis. Says, according to a recent report in the Charlotte Observer, Anna Leigh... My lack of Spanish is showing. Anna Leigh Mateo, L-I-G-I-A, Anna Leigh Mateo, was hired as a secretary for Devonshire Elementary School in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. And she just got canned by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. So I guess the Moran Monday nominee would be the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District. She was fired for speaking Spanish to Spanish-speaking parents. Now, it's entirely possible that I said that too quickly for it to fully sink in. Anna Leigh Mateo is a bilingual woman who speaks both English and Spanish fluently. She was hired to be the school secretary for Devonshire Elementary School in Charlotte, North Carolina. She was hired as such because about a third of the student body at Devonshire Elementary School, how delightfully English a name Devonshire is, for a school about a third of which a student body is Spanish-speaking. And she was caught speaking Spanish to Spanish-speaking parents and was told, don't do that. But... See, right-wingers don't understand this, and I don't know why. Right-wingers are the sort of people that think that if someone doesn't speak your language, if you only speak it more loudly, they'll understand. I said your son is failing English! Don't. This is America. Anna Leigh. You got to make them Spanish-speaking parents speak Merkin, because that's the only way they're ever going to understand anything around here. Got to speak Merkin. Well, see, that's kind of why their children are going to the public school system and they're learning English, because that's the way it always is with waves of immigration. The parents seldom speak the language, the children are bilingual, and then the grandchildren are monolingual in the native tongue. I know. You get it. I get it. Trying to get that through the thick and heavily brow-ridged skull of a right-winger is next to daggum impossible. But it's true. It's true. Here's the fun part. The principal who fired her was Suzanne Jimenez. She showed up at the school and instituted a no Spanish rule. Now, Suzanne Jimenez is not Hispanic herself. She married a Hispanic man and took the name. She instituted a sort of jackbooted rule that English will be the only language spoken in our... Yeah. Y'all want some grits with that? But despite the stupid rule, Ana Lejia Mateo continued to speak in Spanish to parents who had difficulties with English, both in person and on the phone. And see, again, all that business we were talking about with male insecurity and parentage and all of that stuff that leads to the harsh and stupid and draconian and outmoded and caveman-like laws of various and sundry religions. It's the same thing this way. You know why Suzanne Jimenez didn't like Ana Lejia Mateo speaking in Spanish on the phone? I'm her superior. I can't tell she's saying any dirty words in Spanish. They might be talking about me, and I don't know it. I don't want them talking about what the principal does in Spanish. I don't do nothing in Spanish. I do everything in English. No, really. A parent arrived at the office one day, upset, said her son had been sexually assaulted while at school. Suzanne Jimenez did everything in her power to prevent Ana Lejia Mateo from translating for the parent, instead telling the woman's 7-year-old son, who had been sexually abused, to do the translating instead. After another instance, Suzanne Jimenez told her, reprimanding her, either follow the policy of no Spanish speaking or she could leave. Remember when Neil Bortz said, no, it was G. Gordon Liddy, I don't want my children speaking illegal alien. Thank you, Captain Mary, for the nomination. Another nomination in from our buddy David. In South Carolina. He's, you know, such low-hanging fruit here in South Carolina. As in, it's too easy. Sending this story along. South Carolina residents receiving unemployment benefits should be required to take drug tests. And those who test positive should have their benefits cut off until they complete drug treatment. This according to State Senator David Thomas, Repeg-Licking from Greenville. Proposed a bill that would also require recipients who fail a drug test to submit to a random testing. And those who fail the random test would have to get treatment again. And those who fail second random test would lose benefits for a year. Defending his incredibly short-sighted, dumber than a bag of homemade stupid legislation, Senator Thomas said, "My concern is as much for those who are addicted or misusing drugs as for the folks that are paying the bills. Ultimately, I think the question needs to be asked. Should unemployment be provided for people with ongoing drug problems? Because they're using that unemployment money to feed the habit?" No, dumbass. If you're on unemployment in South Carolina, you ain't got no money for no bag of weed. Because you're going to be busting your ass to keep the water and the electricity on. It's that simple. If they're on drugs and it's an issue for them, I can guarantee you they're not seriously looking for work.
Tell you what. And see, this is where, you know, God almighty, we need seminars in how to be a liberal politician. The minute this thing pops up, if there's a liberal anywhere in the South Carolina legislature, there should have been a companion bill introduced to track right along with this one that insisted on drug testing for recipients of public monies.
Shh. Don't tell Senator David Thomas, but he's a recipient of public monies. Mm-hmm. He is.
Yep. And we'll include in that alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, half the South Carolina legislature, most of them are pig lickings, gonna be working for free. Glory.
Yeah, you're right, David. Low-hanging fruit.
And my personal nomination, I'd forgotten all about this.
Ken Ward Jr. is without a doubt the best resource in this country on issues relating journalism. Real journalism. Who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much kind of stuff. He's real persnickety about it. Tries to do all of them, not just one. Oh, this story I'm going to do who? Next one I'll do what? No, he tries to get them all into every story. You'd be surprised. It can be done. And he runs the Cole Tattoo blog. C-O-A-L-T-A-T-T-O-O. My name's Marco in Our World. The Cole Tattoo blog over WVGazette.com. If you want to know about Cole, it's on Cole Tattoo, and if it ain't on Cole Tattoo, it ain't worth knowing, except maybe for one. He's probably got this one, too, by now. Personal Moran nomination goes out to the governor of the great state of West Virginia, Governor Joe Manchin. Headline, Manchin to EPA, leave our coal ash alone. Now, I don't know if my buddy John Wathen, the Hurricane Creek Keeper, has seen this. But I reckon if he has, he's only recently been tracked down and hauled back in the house with a net after running screaming around the yard naked. Manchin to EPA, leave our coal ash alone. Yeah. Governor Joe Manchin has authored an op-ed piece, Coal Ash a Beneficial Resource If Safety Concerns Are Put First. Cyanide a Beneficial Chemical If Not Ingested by Humans. No, sorry, didn't I? No. Coal Ash a Beneficial Resource If Safety Concerns Are Put First. According to the op-ed and quoted by Ken Ward Jr., the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to propose new federal rules that would designate coal ash, a byproduct of using coal to generate electricity, as a hazardous waste. Such a decision would cause significant economic and environmental damage. No, Joe! Trying real hard not to call you a dumbass here. We're going to stick with Moran for all I'm worth. No, Joe. Coal ash causes the environmental damage, not the regulation of it. Oopsie, we're living in an upside-down world again. And I implore the EPA to evaluate the facts about coal ash recycling before making a decision. Jumping to classify coal ash as a hazardous waste would neglect many dozens of years of proven beneficial uses. We come in peace. I was turning into Jim Kirk there. Years of proven beneficial uses of this byproduct hastily raising its status to hazardous. Hastily. You know, after years of study. Hasty. It's too hasty. Need to be moving Brown versus Board of Education style. Need to be moving with all deliberate speed. Deliberate, of course, meaning slow. Many dozens of years of proven beneficial uses of this byproduct. Hastily raising its status to hazardous could actually cause more environmental harm and place undue financial burden. Okay, let's leave out the more environmental harm and get to the crux of the matter. May actually cause undue financial burden on countless thousands of Americans, which, of course, ain't true. Coal fly ash has many beneficial uses. It's a floor wax. It's a dessert topping. And deeming it a hazardous waste could have devastating consequences on industries that use this product. Oh, anybody follow that story a few months back about all the people in the toxic McMansions down in the Southeast, where their houses are killing them and poisoning them and they can't live in them and can't sell in them and can't dump the mortgage and they're just screwed forever? Because the houses were built out of wallboard that was made out of toxic fly ash? Coal? Fly ash? Poor Joe. It's almost painful. One last thing. And why am I not surprised that this comes from Facebook? Facebook, the social networking tool that I love to hate. Hate to love. They are working on a fabulous new installation to house the Facebook headquarters. It's going to be in Oregon. And the Facebook data center will be using a mix of energy, the largest percentage of which will come from, yes, that's right, burning coal. Starting in 2012, the days of super cheap hydro from the Bonneville Power Administration, which Google and Microsoft cashed in on, will draw to a close. Faced with a tiered rate structure from Bonneville, Facebook decided to put down roots in the high desert area of Pineville, Oregon, and get its juice from Pacific Power in a mostly coal package. Here's the fun part. They got a bunch of tax breaks for doing it. And the area has 17% unemployment. Schools are considering a four-day week to cut costs. So they got tax breaks, so there'll be less money for that school district. And as a result, they're gonna get their electricity by burning a boatload more coal. How impressive. Charming. By the way, just a little program note, coming up this Wednesday, I believe, we've pretty much firmed it up, I think I can say this, an absolutely stunning conversation coming for you. Going to be talking with friend of the show, personal friend, writer among writers, Jeff Biggers. Jeff will be on the program to talk about Reckoning at Eagle Creek, his new book. I highly recommend the ownership of this book, by the way. It will be a conversation you will remember for a long, long time. Because Eagle Creek is where Jeff comes from, and where Jeff comes from doesn't really exist anymore, because that part of southern Illinois has been turned into a toxic wasteland by the coal extraction industry. And Jeff has documented it with painstaking detail and will absolutely rivet you to your speakers talking about it. So that's coming up on Wednesday. And I've run plumb out of time. But I want to tell you, first of all, that as I predicted, yes, it's the 15th day of February. And we are so far from reaching our monthly fundraising goal that we can't see it from here. And that's just a damn shame. Because every time we get into one of these situations, It makes me have to start sweating bullets as to whether or not there's going to be a next month of broadcasting. And that is a damn shame. Not for me, but for all of us. Because I get your comments. And I see what you say. And I know what this means to you. And I hope you know what you mean to all of us at the Horn. Not just me, but to Guy and John, to the moderators in the chat room, Lottie and Sue, the news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to the our blogger, Texas Betsy, to our southern correspondent, Matt Osborne, to my staff writer, David in Tennessee. You know what you mean to us. And let me just put a special welcome out there to the newest member of the Horn Broadcast family, Cynthia Black. Action Point with Cynthia Black. Her debut was this past Saturday night at 7 p.m. And wow! I was absolutely spellbound for 3 solid hours. I kid you not. Cynthia is just pure dynamite. If you missed it, you really missed something. Don't miss it next week. And we're working on getting her podcast set up. But we have an opportunity to significantly expand the reach of the Horn. And you've heard me talk about video for a long, long time. Well, Kid A from the chat room, otherwise known as Michael, who has shot video for the Horn in the past and is significantly more knowledgeable on the topic than I. He and I brainstormed a lot over the weekend trying to sort out some questions about how the Horn moves into video. Because when we go and do remote gigs and stuff, I want you to be able to see it as well as hear it. I'm not so crazy about you seeing my ugly mug, but that's part of the process, too. And I really need emails from you. If you want video, I need to hear it, or see it, really. If you would like there to be video of this program as well as audio, I need to know that. Because we've touched base with an organization that can make it happen for us. But they don't work for free. Only we do here at the Horn. And as such, they have the power to expand our reach and our audience base significantly and add more to the members of the Horn family. If you'd like that to happen, I need to know. And if you'd like that to happen, I need to know how much you're willing to kick in to make it happen, because there's equipment and then there's a monthly cost that goes with it. So I would appreciate some input on that. I genuinely would. And I thank you in advance for your consideration as to, because you know what? This is your radio network. This is not my radio network. This is yours. And you determine the reach, and you determine the scope, and you determine its future. It'll take your contributions, and it'll take your participation. But I need to hear from you. BobKincaid@gmail.com. And that's the program for tonight. Hit the PayPal button over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab called Contribute, or you can snail mail it in to the snail mailbox, and Boss Man Wayne picks up the mail every week, whether he needs to or not. And again, thanks go out to everyone I mentioned: John Fox, Peter Godbold, Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk since 2002, literally saved liberal radio on the internet with WhiteRoseSociety.org. Sue, Lottie, Susan, Gene, Texas Betsy, Matt, David. Thanks go out to you all. Thanks also go out to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. They are the hardest working, bravest people I know, and they never shrink from the battle. And they're a part of why the Horn continues to broadcast as well. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It is, in fact, Moran Monday on the horn. A minute past 6 p.m. on the East Coast. I'm Bob, and we are ready for another wonderful week of God only knows what coming our way. But it is Moran Monday, and we have nominees. Oh, yes, we have nominees for Moran Monday. Without a doubt. And also, let's see, a couple of little announcements here and there. Let's see, coming up this Thursday, I will be in absentia. I'll be in absentia because of my local anti-mountaintop removal meeting. So I hope you will forgive me that. But it's, it just comes with the territory when you're trying to save your home. So that's, and also coming up, and I'll have the date for you later. We will be taking the show on the road. We will be taking it to West Virginia State University down in Institute for lectures by Ray McGovern and Bob Perry, Robert Perry of ConsortiumNews.com, what Bart Kopp once upon a time called the most important website on the Internet. And we will be broadcasting that live. And here's the hitch, or here's the wrinkle, if you will. We're going to try something different. We are in fact going to try to stream video of the event live to the world. Frankly, a big part of and I hope everybody had a happy Valentine's Day weekend. Yada yada. I don't pay a lot of attention to Valentine's Day. It gets me in big trouble around here. Happy Valentine's Day to you. Well, happy Valentine's Day to you. It's just another messed up, well, not messed up, but, you know, just another excuse to sell greeting cards in my book.